Here we go.
Everybody is just on the feet screaming, kill, kill, kill. This is hockey.
Oh, my Lord. Wow.
This is the Puck Podcast.
I was very entertained and excited. I couldn't believe how good it was.
Shut your yap.
This is the Puck Podcast.
There's a point where it just becomes absurd.
That was gutless. Gutless.
This is the Puck Podcast.
Hi, I'm Wayne Gretzky, and you're listening to The Real Great One.
This is the Puck Podcast with Eddie Garcia and Doug Stolhan.
Okay, guys, show us what you got.
From Los Angeles, I'm Eddie Garcia, along with Doug Stolhan. Thanks for joining us for another edition of the Puck Podcast. It is Tuesday, June 6th, 2023. On this week's show in the first period, we'll recap the first two games of the Stanley Cup Final. Second period, we'll discuss the news from the past week in the NHL, including GM and coaching hires. We have a three-team trade to tell you about, plus an interview with Ken Bolke from Sin Bin Vegas to talk about the Vegas Golden Knights. And in the third period, we'll read your emails, all that and more on this edition of the Puck Podcast. But before we get into all that, it's time for our quick off-ice report, a couple of minutes about what's going on with us. Doug, how are you? What's going on?
I am very good, thank you, and quite a bit was going on yesterday. Today is much more laid back, but I'll get to that in a second. How are you, my friend?
Busy as well, but doing okay. I do have an update on the relief band that we talked about on last week's show.
Well, let's get to that first and foremost. What is your update?
Well, we tried it out, and it actually worked pretty well. I'm not sure exactly what I thought. I didn't expect it to just be, you can do whatever you want, you're not going to feel anything. But I would say that it does help. If you didn't hear last week's episode, I have motion sickness issues. We go to Disneyland every Friday, my wife and I. She likes to go on these rides that normally I would have trouble with. But
Peter
decided,
Pan, Dumbo.
Yeah.
Mr. Toad's Wild Ride, etc.
The Guardians of the Galaxy ride, which is like, dropping you down several times, kind of like an elevator, but if the cord got cut or whatever, the cable. And then there's the Incredicoaster, which is the big roller coaster there. She doesn't like Star Tours. That one gets to her, so that's not an issue. We haven't done Space Mountain yet.
Star Tours is the one ride that I ever went on in costume.
Oh, really? What were you dressed as?
When I was working at Star Tours, Disneyland, Star Tours is where Star Tours exits into the Star Trader, I should say.
Okay. All right.
So I was working at the Star Trader in the merchandise shop.
Is that allowed? I mean,
no.
I've never seen that. Oh, okay.
No.
There you go.
So somebody had left something, and they said to go and return it to the people at the beginning of the line where you first get into the ride. So I go around and I give it to them, and I said, I need to get back to Star Trader. And the guy said, you can just go right on through. The doors open up, you go right on through. Except they open up on one side and close on the other. So they open on the right to let everybody out, and then those close, and they open on the left to let everybody in. So you don't see the people leaving. It looks like it's your... So the guy's like, oh, no problem. I'll open the doors for you. Go on in. So I go in, and they load the ride, and they never open the doors for me to get through. So I'm like, hey, I need the doors. He's like, oh, yeah, one second. He shuts the doors. And the ride starts, and the guy's like, hi, welcome to Star Trek. I'm like, okay. So I sit down. Luckily, there was an empty seat. Buckle in. Enjoy the ride. When we're done, I get out with everybody else. And I kind of, as I am known to do with my improvisational skills, I kind of tell people, hope you enjoyed the ride, folks. Come on in and get some souvenirs or merchandise, because we're going right into the stuff that sells them. So I go... I come walking out with the group and my coworker, I forget his name, Keith, I think. We were good friends back then, 30 years ago. Keith sees me coming in doing the sales pitch, and I'm like, Keith here, we'll help you well, ring up all your sales. And I kind of do the duck around, and I went to tell my manager, like, hey, if anybody brings anything up, here's what happened. But yeah, that was the only time. You're not supposed to obviously enjoy the rides as an employee in costume. It's not like on my quick break, I go run over and let me cut in front. But yeah, anyway, so you don't like those rides. It's to help with motion sickness on rides like that. And yeah. You had bought it in the past. You then took it. The batteries were dead. You got very sick from going on the Guardians of the Galaxy ride. And week two, action.
So it looks kind of like a watch, and but the face of the watch would be like on the underside, kind of where you check for your pulse, right? On the other side of your wrist. You've got this little goo you put on there as like a conductor, I guess, of the electrical current that goes through. And it's got five settings. So I put it on setting one, and you know, we didn't put the batteries in until we got there to make sure that we had no issues this time. So I put on setting one, I can't even feel it. I go setting two, I can barely feel it. Put it on setting three, I'm like, okay, I can definitely feel that. It's kind of a weird sensation. It kind of feels like you're getting shocked, basically, intermittently. You know, it's got like a pulse. So I put it on four, I'm like, it's a little much. Five was way too uncomfortable. So I left it on three. And so it's like, okay, we got to test it out to see how it goes. Let's ease our way into it. So we went on three rides that I normally handle okay, but we've never like done them like back to back to back. So we went on the Rise of the Resistance Star Wars ride, which at the very end has a Star Tours kind of a thing. Then we went on Big Thunder Mountain, which is a smaller roller coaster. And then we went on a Matterhorn. And I felt perfectly fine on all of them. So I'm like, all right, let's up the ante. Let's go do the Incredicoaster, the big roller coaster at California Adventure. So we went over there, we went on it, and if I didn't have that thing on, I think I would have been in bad shape. But I did feel the effects of it. We got off, I sat down for about 5 minutes, and then I felt pretty normal. So it didn't completely, take all of the feelings away, but I did recover pretty quickly. But I will say, having that thing on all day also made me feel a little weird. I don't know how any other way to put it. It didn't make me feel bad. It wasn't unbearable, but there was something that just kind of was like, this feels a little different, but it was okay. So there's a certain thing you have to, it's
a give and take.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. So I would recommend it. Especially for someone who's like maybe going on a plane or a boat that's not really looking to push it, but just trying to get some kind of relief from that. Don't want to be sick going on vacation or something. But if you just think you're going to get it and go on all these roller coasters all day long and you're going to be completely normal, it's not that, but it did help. So
I can see the headline recommendation now. Eddie Garcia of San Pedro says, after going on a roller coaster, I sat down for about 5 minutes and felt pretty normal. Thank you.
Well, at least you're getting an honest, right?
No, I know.
It's not
going
to be just the bull crap. This thing's amazing.
Look, you would have been sick and day ruined if it wasn't for that. So then it worked.
So my I haven't talked about this with my wife, but I think my plan is to try and again appease her and not get me sick is to have this thing on standby, and then maybe the last ride of the day we go on whatever she wants to go on. And then if it turns out that I don't feel good, well, we're going home anyway, so who cares? So yeah. We'll see. But it was I would say it was moderately successful.
All right. This concludes the Eddie Garcia off-ice report.
Yes.
Of his motion sickness. So yesterday was game two of the Stanley Cup final.
Yes, it was.
I did not see or hear any of it. And I didn't miss much of a game.
That's true, unfortunately.
What was I doing, you may ask? Well, I drove from my house to San Francisco, watched a advanced screening of The Flash for free, and then drove home.
You have some very interesting luck with winning these trips.
Yeah.
You went to New York and saw Black Adam, which, by the way, apparently no one wants me to see, because I've tried to watch it a couple of times now, and it won't stream on my HBO Max app. So I don't know what's going on with that, but I have tried a couple of times. Huh. So what was the circumstances behind you getting this this trip?
This was again a DC, because I'm a DC
preferred member,
I guess. I mean, yeah, it's a you know, I'm in their NFT program called Bat Cowls. I have a bat cowl. I have a program or a basically it's a DC fan thing, and they'll send you invitations and opportunities for different things. So I did that and was able to get a ticket to the Flash advanced screening, and it was fantastic.
Where was it at?
It was at just a regular AMC movie theater in San Francisco.
Okay.
And so I got that, and
When did you leave? What time was the show? When did you leave? And did you just immediately get in your car and drive right back afterwards?
Yes and yes. So I left at 11 a.m. The movie was at 7 p.m. I didn't want to give any chance of being late or missing it, because you're going to go all that way. You get there early. So Jackie was nice enough to pack me up a nice lunch, some snacks, some drinks. I had a thermos of coffee. Off I go. I got there at about 4 and parked between 4 and 4:30. Parked, had a nice lunch, late lunch, early dinner. Took my time. Went over to the theater about 6. I'm outside the theater, and I said, I'm here for the Flash. They said, oh, your line's over there. The ticket that I had allowed me to go to the front of the line. I didn't have to wait in line. I could go to the front of the line and get whatever seat I wanted. So I did that. That did not make the people that were at the front of the line happy, but hey, DC offered it. I didn't ask for it. So I get up there, and there were a few other people that had gotten the same kind of invitation, and I was wearing a t-shirt of the Flash, as you do at such an occasion. And a gentleman, probably about 70 years old, was also wearing the same shirt.
Did that make you feel good or no? Or did you?
No, it's fine. I mean, we're all geeking out at this thing. You know, it's like going to a sporting event and everybody's wearing a jersey.
All right,
okay.
Yeah.
So he comes up to me, because I'm by myself. He comes up to me and he's like, "Oh, you like the Flash?" No, sir. But anyway, I'm you know, yeah. So we're talking. He was telling me about his comic book collection that he had procured, and then he was in the military and fighting overseas. And when he came back, his little brother had thrown them all away, and he was mad at his mom for letting him throw them all away. He's like, I had an original X-Men number one and all this stuff. And I'm like, oh, that's terrible. You're over there fighting for our country. And what happened to the, you know, leaving the light in the window and the yellow ribbon and the star and all that? He's like, terrible. So we were talking about that. And then we go in. Our group of DC fans got the best seats in the house, basically, because we got to go in first. We get the best seats. We're sitting down. We enjoy the movie. Guy comes out. He says, okay, you guys are going to see the full movie with all the footage. They had screenings a week before where they held back certain things to not spoil it. So he said, you're getting to see the whole movie. Everybody's happy. We watch it. It's fantastic. I really hope everybody sees this before it gets spoiled for them, because it will. If you're online a lot, you're going to find out different things. But not knowing what's coming up, the movie is fantastic. I would say it's what Multiverse of Madness should have been. It's great fan service, great moments throughout. Very well done movie. Very fun. Of course, I take that for a grain of salt. I'm a DC fan, so. But I think you'll enjoy it. I think it's a very good movie. And so we get out, and the guy, that's in his 70s sees me, and we're in the lobby because they're hanging out posters for the event afterwards. Little small posters, not huge things at least. And he sees me across the lobby, gives me the thumbs up. I give him the thumbs up, and I'm like, here's a military veteran that is, I think he was probably, I'm thinking 70. You know, I always think those guys were like World War II, but he's not old enough for World War II, so he's probably like Vietnam.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and but I'm thinking here's, and he's got his military hat on with all his decorate, you know, the things. Yep. He was in, and I'm thinking here's a Vietnam vet that's a man's man, and I am certainly not. And but we're bonding over this and all the people in the theater, and there were a few people in the theater. There's a few references in the movie that are deep cuts for comic fans. One of them was so deep, I had no idea what they were talking about. What one guy in the theater, he absolutely got it. And he starts laughing and he's like, ah, yes, yes. And he starts clapping. I'm like, well, that guy got that reference, whatever it was. Because it was obvious they were making a reference to something. But I'm like, I have no idea what they're talking about. So I think it's for very casual fans, very deep cut fans, and just people that like a good time at the movies. It's a good movie just overall. You don't have to see anything to be... You go in, you don't have to worry about, oh, I haven't seen this, that, or the other. They'll explain everything. It's not one of those where you got to watch five series and three movies to get caught up. But very enjoyable. And so it was a long night, though. So as soon as the movie was over, got the poster, got back in my car, drove home, got home about 3:30 in the morning.
Woo.
And went to bed, got up this morning, and we have a contractor here doing some work in the garage. Let him in this morning and have been going all day. So I'm ready for bed tonight, but it was very fun. And I'm very appreciative that I got the invite and the opportunity, and wish it had been closer to the house, but glad I have the ability to drop everything and kind of go to that. And, you know, I looked at flights, and because you always hear about it's only a $39 flight to San Francisco, right? If you don't have any bags or anything like that. No, it's not. It was $200-some each way.
Oh my.
And I'm like, for a tank of gas, I can get to San Francisco. And for a tank of gas, I can get home. And that's exactly what it was. So packed my lunch, no problem. Satellite radio being what it is, I had plenty of entertainment. But the thing is, I got there and was basically going into the theater right when the game would have started. And by the time I got out, the game was well over. And as I said, I didn't miss much. I looked at the score and I'm like, well, I will check the highlights and stuff tomorrow, and I think I'll be caught up.
Well, glad you had a fun trip. And with that, I guess we'll get into the first two games of the Stanley Cup Final. And I think what we're going to do, I'm going to call an audible here. I think we'll play the Ken Bohlke interview after we talk about game two to just keep it all kind of nice and tidy. And he's talking all about the Vegas Golden Knights and what they've done through two games. So let's just go ahead and have the interview here at the tail end of the first period. And then the second period will be all about the news from the past week. And there's lots of stuff to discuss. So let us get into game one of the Stanley Cup Final in Las Vegas. Vegas Golden Knights taking on the Florida Panthers. The Golden Knights, the one seed in the West against the scrappy Cinderella 8th seed Florida Panthers in the East. In this one, it would be the Panthers that would score the first goal of the Stanley Cup Final for this year. Eric Staal with a shorthanded goal on a wraparound to make it 1-0. Third time in Stanley Cup Final history that the opening goal of the series was scored shorthanded. I think Kurt Maltby of the Red Wings was the other guy. And then before that, it was somebody in the 30s, like for the Maple Leafs or something.
Before I forget,
yeah.
And while we're talking about Eric Staal, full credit and marks to his brother Mark, who looks like a Viking of days gone by with his beard right now. Have you seen his look, Ed?
It's hard to miss. I mean, you can actually pick him out on the ice.
Yeah.
Him and Radko Gudas are both the Viking brothers out there.
That is, yeah, but just the red, the fire red hair and beard and just long, it looks extraordinary. I think he should keep that look going all year long.
The Vegas Golden Knights would tie it up in the first period. Jonathan Marchessault on the power play, his 10th of the playoffs, to make it 1-1. Terrible defensive coverage in front of the net by the Panthers. It's probably a bad idea to leave a guy all alone in front of the net when you're shorthanded. But it was 1-1 after one period. Second period, Vegas would take their first lead of the final. Shea Theodore with his first of the playoffs on a nice little move at the blue line to keep it alive, then able to shoot it past Sergei Bobrovsky. But Panthers would respond. Anthony Duclair scoring his fourth of the postseason right off a faceoff win. Immediately shoots it with a one-timer in the net. And we were tied 2-2 going into the third period. However, the third period would belong to the Vegas Golden Knights. Defenseman Zach Whitecloud would score to give them a 3-2 advantage. Mark Stone would then score a bit of a controversial goal. A great play to knock the puck out of midair. But it looked like it might have been played with a high stick. It was challenged by the Florida Panthers, and the challenge was not upheld. So the goal counted, and Florida went shorthanded. Vegas wouldn't score on the ensuing power play, but for Mark Stone, great play. I don't know. I thought that was very close to being over his shoulders. Then Don Koharski, the rules analyst for TNT, who's not good, came in and said that he said that when you play the puck with the stick, it's where you would be if you were standing straight up. So, correct. In other words, Mark Stone was kind of bent over when he reached with his stick to play the puck. So that's something I had not known. Maybe you did, Doug. I did not know that that was the rule, that it was takes into account where you would be if you were standing completely upright.
Right.
So that made it a little bit, I guess, closer of a play, because initially I thought, oh, that's a high stick. But the goal did count. Great play by Mark Stone, and that would give Vegas the 2-goal advantage. They would seal it with an empty net goal from Riley Smith and skate off with the 5-2 victory. Aiden Hill allowed 2 goals on 35 shots in net for the Golden Knights as he improved to 8-3 this postseason. Or excuse me, that's wrong. Vegas improved to 8-3 this postseason after allowing the first goal of the game, which is interesting. So they've had a lot of come-from-behind wins this postseason. But Aiden Hill, solid game, 2 goals, allowed 35 shots. He had an incredible paddle save in the second period to rob Nick Cousins of a goal. On the other side, Sergei Bobrovsky allowed 4 goals on 33 shots. This was the Panthers' first loss this postseason when scoring the first goal of the game. They had been 8-0. We talked about the rest versus the rust, and Florida had 9 days off. But it was Vegas who looked like the more, energized team. Now, maybe that plays into what you were talking about, Doug, that they're kind of in a groove, that they're right back on the ice kind of doing their thing. But as far as being fresh and rested, it didn't look like that rest had any benefit at all for the Florida Panthers, as they were kind of on their heels. And Vegas, I thought, had a lot more energy in getting that game one victory.
Yeah, a couple things. First of all, the high stick rule, it is based on where your shoulder height would be if you were standing straight up, because it's not fair if you're knocked over. You know, maybe you're on your knees, you got knocked to the ice, you're getting back up, you deflect it. It's obviously not a high stick if it's above your shoulder at that point, because it's still below the crossbar. So the problem is, how do you determine that? How do you determine for every player what their shoulder height would be standing up in relation to where they were on the ice at that time? So I hate that rule. I wish they would do it's the crossbar. That's the height, period. I don't care if you're Zdeno Chara or Matt Zuccarello, it's the crossbar. And for Zuccarello, he could be waving the puck or stick above his head and he would still be fine. And Zdeno Chara could be below his waist and be high stick. So that would be a uniform height for everybody and they could know, the players would know and be able to adjust. So I wish they would do that, but they don't. But you would think if rest was going to help you, you would think it would be in the third period of a tied game. And the legs are a little bit heavy for Vegas because they've been playing recently and you've had 9 days off. So you've got a little bit more life in your legs. You've got a little bit more energy in the third period. And that was exact opposite of the case. In the third period, the shots were even, 13-12 in favor of Vegas, but the play was dominant by Vegas with 3 goals, 2 of them at even strength, you know, that we're not talking about a couple of empty net goals here. Only one of them was an empty netter, and that was Riley Smith's one that sealed it, and that was on the power play even. But two even strength goals, Zach Whitecloud and Mark Stone. So I thought the rust would most impact Sergei Bobrovsky. And in game one, through two periods, I thought, okay, he's looked about like he did in the first two periods. In the third period, I thought, that's not the same guy we saw in the last two rounds, where he was locked down. The last three games against Boston, he was virtually unbeatable. Against Toronto, he was amazing. Against Carolina, he was amazing. That was not the guy we saw in the third period of game number one. So I thought the rust did help, did hurt him in that one. But Vegas took advantage on home ice, crowd behind them with their momentum, playing their style of game. I thought they dictated the tempo, the style that they want to play. It was a Vegas style of game, and the game came to them, and they took advantage of their opportunity. So Aiden Hill made the saves when he needed to. Sergei Bobrovsky did not, and clutch goals from depth guys. You know, Zach Whitecloud is not somebody that you're going into a series worried about stopping. He ends up with the game winner on defense. Shocking that Shea Theodore, that was his first goal of the postseason. That's a guy that you expect to be more impactful offensively, but came at a big time, gets it at the right time, and now he's on the board. So overall, a great first game for Vegas from top to bottom. They always start slow, but they finished strong. They did in this one, up 1-0 with a chance to take a solid 2-0 lead. And for Florida, for the first time, certainly since the Boston series, but maybe the Toronto series a little bit, a challenge to them of how are we going to respond to this. And Toronto, they were able to dictate pretty easily what they were going to do from the beginning. It was a tough series, but they were able to be the better team each time and come through when they needed to. This one they didn't. Now it's a rebound game, and let's see how they would bounce back.
Well, 2 days later, it would be game two again in Vegas, and this one was not as competitive as game number one, as the Golden Knights rolled to a 7-2 victory. Two goals in the first, two goals in the second, and three goals in the third. In the opening period, it was Jonathan Marchessault on the power play opening up the scoring with his 11th goal this postseason. Then Alec Martinez, another defenseman, gets his first of the playoffs. It was 2-0 after one. Second period, Nicholas Roy would score for Vegas to make it 3-0, and then Brett Howden with a goal. That would be it for Sergei Bobrovsky, pulled in the second period and replaced by Alex Lyon. Third period, the Panthers would finally get on the board thanks to some puck luck. Anton Liddell credited with the goal, but it bounced off of Vegas defenseman Alec Martinez and went into the net. Vegas would then respond. Another goal from Jonathan Marchessault, his second of the game, 12th of the postseason. 12 goals in the last 12 games for Jonathan Marchessault. Michael Amadio would score pretty much into an empty net. Matthew Tkachuk would get on the board for his first goal of this series, but then Brett Howden would score his second of the game on the power play. So the Vegas Golden Knights open and close the game with power play goals for Howden, his fifth of the playoffs, and they skate off again with a dominant 7-2 victory. Aiden Hill again solid in net. The two goals allowed on 31 shots, but one of the goals that went off one of his players was certainly not his fault. He's now 9-3 this postseason since taking over in net for the injured Laurent Brossoit. Sergei Bobrovsky, meanwhile, we talked about it, 4 goals allowed on 13 shots before getting pulled. Alex Lyon allowed 3 goals on 15 shots in relief. Bobrovsky had allowed 8 goals on 46, has allowed 8 goals on 46 shots in the first, let's see, that doesn't seem right. Not 8 goals. Yeah, I guess that's right, because he got pulled. Excuse me. So again, Bobrovsky, 8 goals allowed on 46 shots in the first two games of this series. He had allowed a total of 6 goals on 174 shots through the Eastern Conference Finals. Matthew Tkachuk got a pair of 10-minute misconducts in this one. He did have a huge open ice hit on Jack Eichel in this game that looked very serious for Eichel. His helmet went flying off. He was in clear distress as he skated directly off the ice and down into the locker room. But he would return and get a couple of assists for Vegas in this one, so that's good news for him going forward. Of course, he had that neck surgery, and when you saw that, you wondered, could it be some sort of a neck injury? Radko Gudas also took a huge hit in this one from Ivan Barbashev. He did not return, and his status for Game 3 is unknown. For the Panthers, 0-7 on the power play so far through the first two games of the series. Panthers are still looking for their first ever Stanley Cup final win. They're now 0-6 in their history in the Stanley Cup finals. Florida was down 0-2 in this one after winning 11 of 12 coming into the final. Vegas with a 2-0 series lead. Teams that have taken a 2-0 series lead in the final have won 90.6% of the time. Vegas has had 12 goals scored from 9 different players so far. Of course, Florida was down 3-1 to Boston to rally back and win the series. But have this stat in mind. The Florida Panthers have never won a game at T-Mobile Arena. That will obviously have to change if they're going to get back in the series 0-7 in their history.
Yeah, the this game was kind of, watching the highlights was kind of what I feared for Bobrovsky, was the magic is gone. He was unbelievable. And remember, for those that think, well, he's an elite goalie, he's a two-time Vezina winner, blah, blah, blah. He didn't even start the playoffs as the starting goalie. Alex Lyon did. And that tells you how much confidence the team had in him that he had lost the starting job. Now, he came in, rallied them back past Boston, beat Toronto, beat Carolina in amazing fashion. And I kept thinking, I know he's not this good anymore. So he can he continue this for a full playoffs? And that's why I've been picking against him every step of the way. The first goal was not his fault. An absolutely brilliant screen by Mark Stone. He was peeking over the Mark Stone's right shoulder. The shot from Marchessault went past Stone on his left. So beautiful goal there. But the second goal from Alec Martinez, I think you got to stop if you want to win a Stanley Cup final game. Certainly the goals in the second period, both were stoppable. You know, Brett Howden, a beautiful rush play. I'm not going to say it was the easiest thing to stop, but he stops that in the second and third rounds of these playoffs. He makes that save and frustrates the team and gets them looking up at the sky. So it kind of fell off there. And now by putting in Alex Lyon and getting him to give up goals in the third period, where do you go for game three if you're Paul Maurice? If you had held off, if you had put Bobrovsky out there for the rest of the game, you could have gone to Lyon as the unknown commodity that the Golden Knights have not seen, have not beaten. But they've seen him, they've beaten him, so where do you go? I think you have to go back to Bobrovsky in game three on home ice and hope that the veteran is able to put a bad game behind him. He's certainly done that in the past. This is nothing new to him in his career. And rally with a good effort and get back into that form we saw against Toronto, against Boston, against Carolina. But Vegas has had their way so far. As you said, the goals have been plentiful. A variety of people are scoring from up and down the lineup. This is not a, gee, how do we stop Leon Draisaitl? How do we stop this one player? It's everybody. And that's a problem for Florida. They got to get back into the game that we saw in the second and third rounds, and they got to do it quickly. Now, nothing, no damage done yet. They've lost two road games. Okay. Win on home ice, win your three home games, and take your chances in game seven, or maybe you sneak a win on the road in game five in Vegas, and you have a chance to close it out on your home ice in game six. But you have to take care of your business on home ice. These next two games are obviously crucial for Florida, starting with game three. Not a must win, but a very strongly suggested win, because if you win game three, the whole tone of the series changes. 2-1, you've won game three. You're back in it. You've got your confidence. Vegas is feeling a little bit of doubt, wondering what to do, how to adjust. And maybe you can tie it up in game four, as opposed to Vegas takes a 3-0 series lead and it's all but over. Now it's just a matter of when does Vegas get the Stanley Cup, because they got four chances to close it out, two of which will be on home ice, at least two, or at most two. So it's a big game three, obviously, for Florida. And the question is, who does Paul Maurice start? What changes do they make to their defensive system to prevent the kind of chances we've seen? How do they change their penalty kill to be more effective against Vegas, who's having a very effective penalty kill or power play so far? And the interesting part of this has been the play of Jonathan Marchessault, who is a former Florida Panther, who they gave up to him in the expansion draft. They made a guy that was a 30-goal scorer for him available in the expansion draft. Vegas took him, and he is absolutely killing them in this Stanley Cup final. Who could have predicted that when the expansion draft happened, that this is going to come back to haunt Florida in the Stanley Cup final? And yet here we are, and Jonathan Marchessault, who, by the way, a lot of people may remember was on the Tampa Bay Lightning, but he was on the Columbus Blue Jackets before that. And the Blue Jackets have to be looking back and saying, why did we get rid of this guy? He was traded to the Lightning, Eddie, and we could go back and talk about this trade. I guarantee we mentioned it and never said anything about it at the time it happened. It was in 2014. It was in March of 2014, so at the trade deadline. Blue Jackets get Dana Tyrell and Matt Tormina. I don't even know if I'm saying that right. In exchange for Dalton Smith and Jonathan Marchessault. No chance we had a hot take or a strong opinion of what they were giving up at that time. But he went on to have a good career with the Lightning. They then weren't able to sign him. Florida got him for 1 year. Now he's on Vegas, and he's on the cusp of winning a Stanley Cup as an original member of the Vegas Golden Knights. And for Vegas, a lot of teams have gone after them and been physical against them, and Vegas brings out that in teams, the way they play, the style of play that they have, and the players that they have will get under your skin. And it's the playoffs. That's the nature of the playoffs, is there's going to be pushing and shoving. But the NHL, I think, is going to have to deal with the fact very quickly here that the Stanley Cup is going to be in Las Vegas, Nevada, and a team that did not exist 7 years ago is going to be the best team in hockey. And all the teams that have been around for decades or have been on cup droughts for decades have got to look at what they were able to do and how they were able to continue to build and with bold moves build this roster, not be afraid to make big swings on roster trades and not be afraid to offend people by firing them or getting rid of them before they were, you know, Marc-Andre Fleury, the different players, Max Pacioretty, the different players that they've sent packing, and maybe not in the most professional way, but they're all about making the move that helps them right now and not worrying about hurt feelings or long-term effect. And that can have its negatives, but right now it's really paying its dividend. Now, they got a great fantasy or expansion draft. They haven't won anything yet. But by the time we talk to you next week, they could be the defending Stanley Cup champions, and we could be recapping the parade, and I think we will be. I think this series is over by the time we're on the air next week.
Well, I would agree with you that Sergei Bobrovsky is not quite up to the level that he was at coming into this series. I also would say, though, he hasn't been getting a ton of help from his defense. The Panthers' forecheck game just has not been there, which was so effective so far in the playoffs. Vegas is just looks so much faster and has so much more energy, and their entries into the zone are so easy at this point. Special teams have definitely favored Vegas, as you've said. Panthers still looking for their first power play goal. They've got to be able to try and make that more of an even category for them going forward. Matthew Tkachuk, he had the huge hit on Jack Eichel, and I know because it was Matthew Tkachuk, in the moment with Eichel's helmet shooting off, like you like to say, like the champagne cork, I think in the moment we all kind of thought, uh-oh, that's a dirty play. But then on review, you saw that Eichel had toe-picked. He was off balance. He almost kind of fell into Tkachuk as he was hitting him, so it was not a dirty hit. But Matthew Tkachuk, obviously his part of his game is stirring things up. He's gotten three different misconducts so far in the first two games of this series. He had two 10-minute misconducts in game number two. And Vegas has done a masterful job of sticking up for their teammates when necessary, but turning the other cheek and letting Matthew Tkachuk do what he wants to do, getting himself off the ice and being not much of a factor so far, at least positively, for the Florida Panthers. So we'll see how that goes going forward. I think Matthew Tkachuk can't change his style at this point. That's what he is. But I've been pretty impressed with the way Vegas has been able to basically not respond to most of the stuff that he does, and taking advantage when he's been out of the lineup, and making him kind of a non-factor so far in this one.
Well, I will say about Tkachuk's misconducts, they've happened when the game was out of hand. He's not hurting his team when the game is close. The game was 4-0 when he got his first one, and it was 6-2 when he got his second one. So he's not, the games aren't tied when he's getting a misconduct or taking his. So he's going out there and picking his spots of when to be that guy, when to let that part of his personality out. To Vegas's credit, as you mentioned, they are turning the other cheek, and we've seen that throughout the playoffs. We saw Haig laughing at Domi in the last round because they know they've got you where they want you. And I think that comes from, one, the leadership on the team, which was not always the case. They were prone to falling victim to that. Remember how they completely fell apart in the San Jose series after the Pavelski injury, and they got the 5-minute misconduct, and things just fell apart on them very quickly after that. Or not, yeah, that was...
That's 5-minute major.
5-minute major. So that same veteran core, though, is still there and is the leadership of this team now. And I think it's also Bruce Cassidy, who coached Brad Marchand for a long time. And he knows, look, we're going to get under their skin, and that's what we want. We want them to retaliate. And when they retaliate, you have to just skate away. You have to let the referees throw them in the penalty box, and then we take advantage. So I think it's a twofold. But that hit on Eichel was, I had absolutely no problem with it. He didn't leave his feet. He skated through the body. He tucked the arm. He didn't pick the head. The guy's skating right at him in open ice with the puck. I mean, he's eligible to be hit, and hitting is still legal in this sport. And that was a legal hit. So I was glad to see no supplemental discipline for that. I'm not happy that Eichel looked like he was hurt, but that's on him. He put himself in a bad position. So I was, I'm all for those kind of hits in open ice. I want to see that kind of physicality in hockey. It's part of the sport that I like, is the hitting and the skill. It's the combination of the two. Same reason I like football. There's violence and there's skill, and they go on the same play. They can be displayed, and that's part of the appeal. So I don't want to see that taken out of hockey, and I'm glad it wasn't disciplined at the time or by the league. But Matthew Tkachuk's impact has got to be on the score sheet if they want to turn this series around. He's doing what he can to set the tone physically and let people know he's going to be around. But ultimately, he and his teammates need to come through, and we need to see more from Carter Verhaeghe, who was a contributor. A lot of different people need to step up in Game 3 if they're going to win. But primarily, the goal has to be, and I think Paul Maurice would tell them this in practice, we need to keep Vegas to 2 or 3 goals. We can't outscore them 6-5. Let's worry about our defensive zone first and the counterpunch, and then if we get our special teams going, then we can try and win a game 3-2, 4-3 at the most. But we got to be better defensively, and it starts there. And if we can do that, then we have something to build on.
Well, we're going to have the Ken Bohlke interview here in just a second, but we will have two more games coming up before our next show. Actually, I don't know if you're available for this, Doug, but maybe we go ahead and set our next episode to be on Wednesday, if that is okay with you, as there is a Game 5 on Tuesday. Now, if this ends up in a sweep, we'll do our show normally on that Tuesday, but if it does extend to a fifth game, then let's try and get that fifth game in and do our next episode on a Wednesday. So just a heads up, if you're listening, if that ends up being the case, we'll probably do our, if it's not a sweep, we'll probably do our show next week on a Wednesday so we can get that game 5 in. But right now you've got game 3 coming up Thursday in Florida, game 4 Saturday in Florida, and then if necessary, a game 5 Tuesday in Las Vegas. We're excited to be joined by Ken Bohlke from Sin Bin Vegas, Las Vegas' first website focused exclusively on the Vegas Golden Knights. You can follow him at Sin Bin Vegas. Hey, Ken, I know it's a busy and exciting time for you. Appreciate you giving us a few minutes.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
So let's just start off by what were your thoughts on this Stanley Cup final matchup going into it, and how you feeling now after two games? I think I know how you're feeling, but how you feeling now as opposed to maybe what you thought going into the series?
Yeah, I thought going in, I thought both teams were fairly similar. They want to do kind of the same types of things. They generate offense the same kind of way. They're trying to defend the same types of way. I thought maybe that the forecheck would be a little bit more aggressive on Florida. They'd be a little bit more physical. Golden Knights have had a little bit of trouble with that as a over the course of the postseason to this point. And then I thought Vegas was probably going to have the stronger defense. Goalie, I assumed Florida would be better. That hasn't been the case. And then at this point, Vegas has been better in basically every single area of the ice. They've been the more disciplined team. They've been the better forechecking team. They've certainly been more consistent breaking out of their zone. They've got the better goaltending. They've made the adjustment inside of how they wanted to play. Something I was not expecting was that they're willing to take more shots from the point, a little bit more from the outside, kind of get that traffic in front and try to generate that way. Not something they've done over the course of the season. They have done it so far in this series, 3 goals by defensemen already, where they only had 3 coming into the series in the first 12 playoff wins. So definitely feel pretty confident with how it's gone through 2 games, and I would be fairly surprised if they can't find a way to win 2 of the next 5.
I know that going into the series, a lot of attention being paid to Florida as that kind of Cinderella, the 8th seed that barely squeaked in and having this amazing run. But when you look at the Golden Knights, and I know obviously you know this very specifically, but maybe for people who don't know the whole story, the season for the Golden Knights has been pretty amazing, especially when you consider all the things they've had to endure in net. Just give us a recap from Robin Leonard now to Aiden Hill.
Yeah, so it starts out, obviously, the plan was when they hired Bruce Cassidy, the hope was that it was going to be Robin Leonard, and then Bressois was coming off of a surgery, and they expected him to be back sometime kind of towards the end of the calendar year, so, you know, not that far into the season. And then they knew they had Logan Thompson as kind of the guy behind them, and they got word over the summer that, and of course, perfectly timed after free agency had already begun and basically the goalie carousel had already spun, they got word that Robin Leonard was going to be out for the season. And then it seemed also like Laurent Bressois' injury was probably going to stretch potentially all the way into 2023. So they got to the point where they're like, well, I guess Logan's going to be the guy to start, and then we got to find somebody else to potentially be an option moving forward. And so they went out and they traded a pick for Aiden Hill. Season started. It was kind of a little bit of a back and forth, but certainly leaning more towards Thompson. He kind of established himself as the clear starter. He was definitely better than Hill, or at least the eye test and the, kind of just watching them, became clear that he was better than Hill. He ends up being an all-star. And in the very first game out of the all-star break, Thompson gets hurt, played 58 minutes in that game, and has not played since. Hill kind of took the reins at that point, but then he got hurt. Bressois took the reins. He got hurt. Quick got in there. They put in Yuri Patera, another prospect they drafted in their first draft. And it came into the postseason with Bressois being the guy, with Hill not even fully healthy. And then Bressois got hurt, and Hill kind of got thrust in, and he has been playing essentially at a Conn Smythe level ever since. It's been a pretty unbelievable ride that just recapping it now, it still doesn't seem real.
And another great story, and you mentioned it briefly, Bruce Cassidy gets fired by the Bruins after some successful seasons in Boston. The Bruins go on to have this huge year, but then they get bounced in the first round, and now here's Bruce Cassidy in the final. I'd say it's worked out pretty well for him.
Yeah, I don't think anybody really thought that Bruce Cassidy was the problem with the Bruins, and even when the Bruins were going on their awesome regular season run, I don't think there was a lot of people saying, well, Bruce Cassidy was the problem. He's the reason that they're struggling. He's why they're so much better now, because he walked into Vegas and they ran out to a 13-2 start, and his system works. We know his system works. Obviously, it doesn't. It's like any system in the NHL or in hockey in general. It's not going to be perfect, and there are certain things that you can do to beat it, but it seems to have been kind of the perfect fit when the Golden Knights are at full health. They were at full health to start the season. They started out 13-2. They were at full health for a good portion of down the stretch, obviously missing Mark Stone in that time, but everyone else was pretty much healthy, and they had a good run to end the season. Now, postseason, they've literally been at full health. They've only had 2 guys miss any time at all, and that was, other than the goalie, but that was McNabb and Theodore, both in the same game, in Game 5 against Winnipeg. Every other game, they've used the exact same lineup, and they've switched 1 guy in and out, but it's a healthy decision. And when they're healthy, when they've got all their players, when they're able to roll their lines and their pairs the way they can, they've been able to play to this system. And And it's been pretty impressive how they've implemented this, stuck with it, and then used these little tweaks against different opponents to kind of change a little bit of the tenor of how they want to play to be this very adaptable but also under control team.
Obviously, up 2-0, you're feeling confident, justifiably so. I did see that you had posted a video on Twitter talking about this Golden Knights team now officially being the best team in Vegas's brief history. Maybe you could talk about that a little bit.
Yeah, so obviously the first year they went to the Stanley Cup final, and that was always kind of the gold standard for the Golden Knights, having been there and had that magical run, and it was kind of a season that it was going to be awfully difficult to eclipse it. And what makes them officially the best team they've ever had is simply they've won their 14th playoff game, where that team only won 13. That team won game one of the Stanley Cup final and then lost four consecutive games to Washington. This team now has eclipsed that. They're one past it. But I also think when you look at just the style of play and how they're going about this and the way they've gotten to this point and now having this two-game lead in the Stanley Cup final and have not trailed in a series since game one of round one, and that only lasted for that game as they won the next one. They're really putting together they've become a team that does not have a weakness. There are things they may not do as well as some other teams, but there's certainly not something you can circle and say, that's it. Attack that portion of their game, which is something that all of these teams in the past had, including that team that went to the Stanley Cup final in year one. That team ran into a team that exposed them defensively. They were able to expose their defensive zone and beat them four games in a row. This team does not have that weakness, and I don't know that Florida's going to be able to find it.
We're talking with Ken Bohlke from Sin Bin Vegas, and obviously going into the series, being able to handle Matthew Tkachuk was going to be a key. He certainly has tried to stir things up. Obviously, in game two, he had the big hit on Jack Eichel. Just your thoughts on how Vegas has been able to handle Matthew Tkachuk so far.
I think they've done more than handle him. I think he's become a liability for Florida. I think he's hurting as much as he's helping. Now, granted, you know, he set up the play that Aiden Hill makes the unbelievable save on, and if that one goes in, maybe we have a little bit of a different view of what he's doing. He is getting shots off. He is, you know, doing the same things. He's, you know, clobbered Jack Eichel at the one point in the middle of that game. You know, he's doing some of that, but at the same time, if you really watch him closely, he's over-aggressive on his forecheck. He's over-aggressive on some of these plays through the neutral zone. He's trying to get things done because he knows that his team needs him to do some of these things. And the Golden Knights are basically just playing straight up against him, not necessarily line matching, not necessarily looking for a specific defensive pair in him, just making sure they're doing the right things when he's on the ice. And you can see that frustration is growing and growing and growing for him. And he's going out there now trying to find a big hit, trying to make a big play. And oftentimes it's feeding directly into what the Golden Knights want to do. Because if you find yourself on the wrong side of a turnover in Vegas's defensive zone, they're going to spring a transition chance on you consistently. And they've done that with Tkachuk out on the ice quite a bit. I honestly do believe he's been as impactful positively as negatively for Florida to this point, and that's a huge credit to what the Golden Knights are doing against it.
Well, what a positive Jonathan Marchessault has been for Vegas in this postseason, and specifically now in this series, taking it to another level. Or is this the player he's kind of become in Vegas, and we're all just now noticing it because he's on this big stage?
I mean, he's always been somewhat of a streaky scorer. You know, he's always... there are times where he's going to come through with the big goal, and then there are also going to be games where he takes a little bit of that unnecessary penalty or, you know, just isn't necessarily the catalyst of their offense. But I think for the most part, this is Jonathan Marchessault. Now, obviously, 13 goals or whatever it is to this point in a postseason run, after having not scored in any of the first six games in the postseason, like, the run he's on is pretty darn impressive. And so it's not like, yeah, this is the expectation of what we were supposed to get out of Jonathan Marchessault, but this has always been his game. He's always going to score that big time goal if you give him the opportunity. If you leave him skating down the slot with nobody anywhere near him, yeah, he's going to beat Alex Lyon every single time. Like, that's who he is. So just the style of play. I think what people are starting to realize, though, is the clutch factor that he has. You can't always put your finger on what exactly that means or how that comes to light, but he's typically the guy that gets the biggest goals for the Golden Knights, and he's clearly done that in this series.
I believe I heard that Vegas owner Bill Foley had a six-year plan to win the Cup, and I know that there's, you know, every team says we have a plan to win the Cup. But when you look at Vegas and, you know, in their brief history, the aggressiveness, the boldness that they have been willing to do in a real attempt to go out and win and get a Stanley Cup, they go out and get Jack Eichel, for example. Can you talk about just kind of that mindset that it seems that they have had since their inception?
Well, so it was the original plan, and this was, I'm talking as far back as early 2016. So before they've even announced that they're going to bring a franchise to Vegas, he had always said, we're going to go to the playoffs in year three, and we're going to win the Stanley Cup in year six. And so this is year six. So the idea was that's the plan. That's how they're going to try to build the team. But obviously, when you get the team and you're in first place at the trade deadline, you're in this situation where you look like you're one of the best teams in the Western Conference and in the NHL in year one, all of a sudden that plan is going to change. And I think that their focus was on, okay, well, we've got an opportunity. Let's try to get it done right here, right now. They attempted that. They came up a little bit short. They then went out, made the big-time deal in the offseason to go get Max Pacioretty. They signed Paul Stastny. They ended up making the trade for Mark Stone. And these are all things that I think would have probably happened anyway on path to that six-year plan of let's be one of the best teams in the league, if not the best team in the league by year six. It just all kind of got accelerated. And as it got accelerated, I think it kind of changed the focus of how things were going. Like, they were willing to make that big deal. They were always going to be willing to make that big move. But what came with it was also making some of the tough decisions of getting rid of a Nate Schmidt, a fan favorite in him, cutting bait on Marc-Andre Fleury, getting rid of Max Pacioretty, getting rid of Paul Stastny, all these guys who made big impacts that I don't think that was necessarily in the six-year plan. It's like, we're going to build up, be young, have our core, and then add to it along the way. Instead, they had this great core, added to it, subtracted from it, added to it, subtracted from it, and eventually have landed on what they've landed on here. And now, obviously, he's two wins away from looking like a prophetic genius if he can, you know, they do end up winning these last two games. They do end up indeed winning the Cup in six. It's pretty amazing that he said that 8 years ago.
So obviously there's still work to be done. You know that, but you're in a good position. I just want to ask you about the community in Vegas. I've been there for games. I know how they have embraced the Golden Knights, seeing the stickers and the license plate frames, you know, all these vehicles. Everybody seems to have some Golden Knights, something on it. People wearing, I go to Disneyland every Friday with my wife. It's kind of our getaway thing. We see Golden Knights jerseys and hats every time we go. On multiple people. So I just wonder what would a victory parade look like in Las Vegas, and what would it mean? We know that there's a baseball team coming. You've got the Raiders that have moved there. But this being the original pro sports franchise in Vegas and how they've been embraced and everything they've done, what would it mean to that community to get the Stanley Cup?
It really is Vegas's team, and it really is the team of everyone that lives here, where when the Oakland Raiders came in, and I'm a good example of this, like, I'm a Tampa Bay Buccaneers fan from my entire life. When the Oakland Raiders came to Vegas and became the Las Vegas Raiders, I'm sorry, I'm not going to be a Raider fan. I don't like the Raiders. I'm not going to stop being a Buccaneer fan. I'm going to keep cheering for that team. Well, when this team came in as the expansion team, as something completely brand new, it wasn't all that hard to say, well, I also like my other team and I like this team. And then if you live in a city where your team is and the other team's not here and this team doesn't lose, like, they've missed the playoffs once, they've been consistently pushing 100 points throughout all of it. This is their second run to the Cup final. They had four runs to the Western Conference final. Of course you're going to gravitate toward that team more so than say you're from Detroit or Chicago or New York or whatever. You know, you're going to end up leaning towards that. But I just think that the first team that came here was always going to have quite a stronghold if they were going to be like the true first team. And then having it be an expansion team and then all that went on the first season and kind of the connection that was made with the tragedy that happened a few days before the first game and then that run to the final and having the superstars along the way and, you know, Carlsons and Marchessos and Smiths and Theodores and then obviously Fleury at the time, I think it was like, hard to not be a fan of this team. There was no reason to not be a fan of this team. And that has just grown and grown and grown as they've done more and more and had all of this success. And what would the parade look like? I have no idea. I mean, it would be, you have to imagine they're going to want to do it down the strip. It's possible they end up looking at maybe doing it down on Fremont Street because they could do the canopy, and that would be pretty neat too. No matter where they do it, how they do it, what it looks like, there's going to be upwards of a million people there, and it's going to be pretty darn wild.
Yeah, I can imagine people that maybe even aren't Golden Knights fans just wanting to go there for the party.
Because, yeah, why not?
Yeah, Vegas has been known to put on a pretty good party or two. Ken, great stuff. Really appreciate it. Awesome job giving you some insight on the Golden Knights. I want to invite everybody again, check out Sinbin Vegas on Twitter, at Sinbin Vegas. Anywhere else they can get your content and you'd like to direct them to?
Yeah, wherever. You'll figure it out.
All right. Hey, Ken, great stuff. Enjoy the rest of the final, and we hope to talk to you again down the road.
Yeah, thanks for having me. I'm on my way to Florida tomorrow.
Time for the second period here on the Puck Podcast. And once again, thanks to the great Ken Bulkey for stopping by from Sinbin Vegas. He definitely knows his Vegas Golden Knights, and he's obviously feeling pretty good about their chances of winning the first Stanley Cup in Vegas Golden Knights history. But,
and I got to give him credit. If you've not watched his show, he has done such an amazing job of establishing himself as the source for Vegas Golden Knights news. That site that he started when they first launched, before they even had a team, and has maintained to this day, is a fantastic source of information. If you're a Golden Knights fan, you don't, I'm not telling you anything you don't know. It's a must. But if you just want to follow the best team in hockey right now, that guy does the best job of anybody of covering them, and has for many years. So thrilled that you were able to get him as a guest this week, Eddie. Like you said, nobody knows, to me, nobody covers Vegas better. And he does as good a job of covering that team as anyone in the league does of covering any team. So
yeah, and he's elite. I've worked in sports media for over 20 years, and you know when you talk to people who know what they're talking about and when you don't. You know what I mean? And that guy knows what he's talking about. So, yes, great to have him on the show, and just good insights from him. So
I know he doesn't work for the team. I know he's just a media member. But I hope that guy gets a day with the cup, because the amount of promotion and marketing that he's done for that team since before they even had a roster deserves that from the team. And I know that the media is supposed to be separate. Nuts to that, man. He's a Golden Knights fan as much as anybody, and lives and dies with that team, and he deserves that celebration if they win it.
There was a lot of news this week in the NHL. Some of it was expected, some of it maybe not, but let's start with a couple of general manager openings being filled. There were two, and they're both filled now at this point, and that includes the Pittsburgh Penguins hiring former Toronto Maple Leafs GM Kyle Dubas as their president of hockey operations, it should be noted, not their general manager, their president of hockey operations. The 37-year-old Dubas, of course, had previously said that he would be in Toronto or nowhere for next season. Well, that obviously changed and should be a reminder to everyone. Don't believe anything that these people ever say.
No, publicly. That's not true. That's not fair. He's going
really?
He's going to work from Toronto.
Oh, is that right?
That would be a great... I will continue to work from my home office in Toronto.
Yeah. No, just have some Skype meetings. Yeah.
Look, it reminds me famously of what Brian Burke said when he was here in Anaheim. I'll be here as long as the Samuelis want me. Well, then he begged them to get out of his contract so that he could go be the GM of the Toronto Maple Leafs. I'm sorry, closer to his family. Wink. So
yeah, I look, people are entitled to change their minds, but I just, again, don't believe anything these people say,
right,
as far as taking jobs or wanting to be with their family or any of that stuff.
It's also why I would never, if I was a player or agent, especially a player, I would never take a hometown discount. Ever. Oh, the loyalty to the franchise. Screw you, man. If you got a better opportunity, you're taking it. if you get more money from another team and another opportunity, you're taking it. My career is limited. I'm getting as much as I can. You want me to take a hometown discount? You've come to the wrong dude.
No, it's true. And fans should absolutely keep that in mind when they call these players, you know, greedy and all that kind of stuff.
Yeah. You're going to take less from the company you're working for right now if another company's willing to hire you? Of course you're not.
No, no. So to Kyle Dubas, he will oversee all aspects of the Penguins hockey operations department. He says he's going to establish a strategic vision and philosophy for the franchise. He will serve as the team's interim general manager until at least July, when he expects to hire a full-time GM, someone he says who is progressive and can add an element to the organization that perhaps I don't have the skill set for, he said. Of course, the Penguins fired the aforementioned Brian Burke as their president of hockey operations and general manager Ron Hextall on April the 14th after Pittsburgh missed the playoffs after 16 straight years of making the postseason. It appears that head coach Mike Sullivan is safe and will be back for next season. At his introductory news conference, Dubas said that he views the task ahead of the Penguins as a two-pronged effort. One, continue to give their veteran core a chance to contend for a fourth Stanley Cup title together, while also laying the groundwork for the next phase of the franchise. Dubas spent the past 5 years as GM in Toronto. Three of the five most successful regular seasons in team history happened while on his watch. Toronto did defeat Tampa Bay in the first round of the playoffs for their first postseason series win since 2004. But as we talked about on the show, Dubas' contract was up. Looked like he was coming back. Then there was some sort of rift between him and Brendan Shanahan. Shanahan decided, you know what? Let's go ahead and part ways. And we heard that Kyle Dubas was the front runner in Pittsburgh. I know you had suggested that was probably not the best idea for him to take this situation. Maybe he should sit out a year and look for something else. But he's decided to go to Pittsburgh as, again, the president of hockey operations. So a promotion for him, I'm sure, more money as well. So we'll see how it goes for Kyle Dubas in Pittsburgh.
Well, that's the thing is I thought he was being considered as the GM. And if he was going to be the GM of the Penguins, that's not the right job for him because it's basically an impossible situation for exactly what he talked about. They want to both give this veteran core a chance to win the cup. They didn't even make the playoffs this past season, but also start a rebuild on the down low. And you're either doing one or the other. You can't ride in two boats at the same time. So by trying to do both things, you're not going to do either one of them very well. But if he's going to be the president of hockey operations, which he is, then that's a great move because you're not the GM. Hire a GM, let that person take the bullets, and when the team fails, you fire him. And you say, this is not what we expected. We expected to be able to compete for a Stanley Cup with this veteran core. I'm very disappointed, and we are going to get this right next going forward. So 100% president of hockey operations, love it. I would take that job for any team in the NHL in a heartbeat because nobody blames the president of hockey operations for the team's failure. You blame, as a fan, you blame the head coach. You may blame the GM. You may blame the players. Nobody's ever like, man, our president of hockey operations is killing this organization. We need a different person at the head of the franchise. So this is perfect.
I don't disagree with you, but Brian Burke was fired as the president of hockey operations, along with Ron Hextall.
But who did fans?
Hextall.
Yes.
Yes, Hextall.
Hextall was the guy that was the problem. Fire Hextall. Nobody was yelling fire Burke. So, and Dubas is 37. If he gets a nice run out of this, let's say 5-10 years, he's still not even 50 and can go do exactly this with another team and somebody else will hire him immediately. So I think this is a great move for Kyle Dubas because it's a huge paycheck, less stress of having to handle every phone call of trade or contract negotiation or any of that stuff. That's what the GM is for. And he's got a team that's in, I think, a very bad situation, one of the worst in the NHL for the next 5 years. I think the Penguins have one of the worst outlooks for the next 5 years of any team in the NHL. Just because of where they are as a roster, the commitments they've already made, and the flexibility that they have. They don't have a lot of young talent coming in. They got a lot of guys that are in locked into long-term big money contracts with no movement or no trade clauses. And I don't think the best days are ahead of them, but that's not Kyle Dubas's problem. He eyes wide open. He didn't build this roster. He's worried about transitioning from this to the next phase long-term. And so it's a great hire for him. It'll be interesting to see. It looks like Mike Sullivan, as you said, is, and Sheldon Keefe is still the head coach of the Toronto Maple Leafs. So where do you go? He can't go bring his guy. I thought that would have been taken care of by now, but they still don't have, haven't made a decision on head coach in Toronto yet. So Mike Sullivan looks safe, as he probably should be. He's been there a long time and had a lot of success with this roster. Give him at least a year. And again, for Kyle Dubas, that's not my decision. That's the decision of my GM. When I hire a GM, I will let that person make that decision. So great move for Kyle Dubas as far as I'm concerned.
Yeah, I don't disagree with that. And I think it's a good move for Pittsburgh. I mean, he's apparently a very well-respected, young, still a young hockey mind. He obviously did have success in Toronto. Now, maybe not the success that the Maple Leafs ultimately want in winning a Stanley Cup, but he was still, I mean, it'd be hard to say he didn't do a good job in Toronto with putting that roster together and everything. And he's going to be working for an ownership group that has deep pockets and for a franchise that is interested in winning. I mean, look, every team has to go through it. Certainly, you know, the Chicago Blackhawks are going through it. My LA Kings have gone through it. Teams that have had success in the past won some Stanley Cups. But in Pittsburgh, they are obviously, you know, one of those franchises that doesn't do lip service as far as wanting to win. They've got a fan base that's very demanding. So I think it's a good situation for Kyle Dubas to go into. It's a good organization to be a part of. And again, they've got ownership that's going to spend. So I think it's a pretty good hire. Now, that doesn't translate into maybe them winning a cup in the next few years or so. I think there is going to have to be eventually when this core, you know, with Malkin and Crosby and those guys eventually move on. But I think it's a good hire for both sides in this one.
Yeah, it's I think he's really going to enjoy the fact that he's going to have a life away from the rink in Pittsburgh.
And out of the, I mean, look, Pittsburgh is, look, they like the Penguins there, but it's not the Steelers, right?
No, that's what I mean. That's what I mean. He's going to be able to go and with his family around town and not be bothered. Not nearly to the degree that he would in Toronto. He can probably go out to dinner, take his kids to a park, the zoo, something like that. And yeah, he'll be recognized and fans may ask us, selfie or an autograph or, you know, hey, but Toronto, there was no private life. There was no escaping it. The scrutiny, the pressure of the media 24/7. And as you said, the Steelers are first, second, and third in Pittsburgh, and then the Penguins, and it'll always be that way. And so I think he's going to enjoy that aspect of it as well.
Meanwhile,
it'll
in
be
Toronto,
interesting. I'm sorry, real quick. I hate to do that to you.
Yeah.
It'll be interesting what his relationship was with players like Austin Matthews, William Nylander, Mitch Marner, if they hit free agency or if they become on the trade market because they are not going to re-sign in Toronto, what relationship does he have with them that might get them to Pittsburgh? And if you want to both help this veteran core and build for the future, getting a guy from one of those young players from Toronto would be a great way to do it.
Meanwhile, in Toronto, the Maple Leafs, as expected, have hired former Calgary Flames GM Brad Treliving as their next general manager, replacing Kyle Dubas. Treliving spent the past 9 seasons as GM in Calgary, guiding the Flames to 5 postseason appearances. Now, they only won 2 rounds in the playoffs during that time, but Calgary did miss the playoffs entirely this past season. And we talked in a previous episode about the circumstances surrounding Brad Treliving stepping away from the Calgary Flames. His contract was up and he wasn't brought back, so they called it a mutual parting. But again, he apparently wanted to fire Daryl Sutter. The ownership said no. He walked away, and then they ended up firing Daryl Sutter anyway. But he's now going.
Rip Taylor and Nipsey Russell are fighting over the gong to see who gets to gong the Calgary Flames ownership for their handling of this offseason. You let your GM go because you don't want to fire the coach, and then you fire the coach anyway?
We talked about the job he did in the offseason. It didn't work out in Calgary, but it certainly wasn't any fault of his own. He had some tough circumstances to have to contend with, and he did the best job he could. And now he goes to, obviously, we talk about Kyle Dubas leaving that pressure cooker and that spotlight. Well, Brad Treliving is now stepping into it. It'll be certainly a big step up from Calgary. He's a very capable guy, but this is a difficult situation, and he's got some decisions to make regarding their core four and all that kind of stuff. If he's going to keep them together. Auston Matthews has got a contract coming up soon, so there are some big decisions to be made there for Brad Treliving in Toronto.
Here's a little trivia for you, Ed. Did you know?
By the way, I loved your Marchessault. I had no idea Jonathan Marchessault had played for the Blue Jackets. I had no idea.
I remember him best as a Blue Jacket.
I'm sure you do. You've got your Marchessault Blue Jacket.
You like that pull?
That was good.
What brought that up?
I just, like I said, I did not know that. That was, I learned something today.
Yeah, and they gave him away for nothing. And we'll get to that in a second because it brings something up. Did you know a little trivia about Brad Treliving that I learned from reading some articles about him? He is the son of Jim Treliving, who is the co-owner of the Boston Pizza chain.
I have no idea if you're telling me the truth or not on these. So I'll just be the sucker and believe you on this. But
that one is
a very
correct.
Interesting fact.
That wow, one is correct. Fact. So. Pizza party for everybody when we win a game. That's what I would say. Boston pizza for everybody. Come on, bring them in, boys. Here come the pies. But no, that is accurate. So he, I think this is a great hire because I think Brad, Calgary is not Toronto, but it also is not Columbus or Anaheim or LA or Florida or something like that. You know, there's pressure still of being the Calgary Flames GM. And their scrutiny. And it's not to the degree of Toronto, but he's used to it. And it's not going to faze him to be in that spotlight. And it's not going to feel like too much for him. And I think this is a team that is still built to win right now. Has a lot of pieces that he can work with that he's coming in to inherit. I like the opportunity for him to immediately turn this team into a successful franchise again. And take them further in the playoffs. So I like this hire a lot. I think it's a great fit for both sides. I think his track record in Calgary was very strong of building a good roster, making savvy trades and getting good value in his trades. As you said, they may not have worked out, but that was not his fault. That was the fault of the coaching staff that he wanted to fire and was not allowed to. And I think with that autonomy to get the coach he wants, we'll see if Sheldon Keefe remains in Toronto. They're saying the right things right now, but I think this is a very good hire. But the work begins immediately for him is figuring out, are we going to be able to extend Auston Matthews, William Nylander, those guys? And if not, do we make a move now before their no-trade deadline or their no-trade clause kicks in? How do we handle that? I'm sure they've already gone over that with Shanahan and the front office. They're on the same page, and now it's a matter of executing that plan, but I really like this hire a lot. I think, I'm not saying they're going to win a Stanley Cup, but I think this is the best person for the job in as far as it, both experience, ability to handle this pressure, and ability to handle the expectations that come with being the Toronto Maple Leafs GM with a roster that is built to win right now.
Some more GM news. The Seattle Kraken signed Ron Francis to a 3-year contract extension through the 2026-27 season after the franchise reached the second round of the NHL playoffs for in its second year of existence. Hired to be the first GM in franchise history, Francis navigated through a difficult first season, helped land players who turned Seattle into a playoff team in his second year without mortgaging the future. And also was able to navigate the salary cap for the Kraken as well. Seattle is the second stop for Francis, was obviously a GM in Carolina, was let go in 2014, and then became the general manager of the Seattle Kraken. So again, after a tremendous season in Seattle, management there in Seattle giving Ron Francis a 3-year contract extension.
How about this, Eddie? Ron Francis, they've had how many seasons in Seattle? Two.
Two.
He is the 14th longest tenured GM in the NHL. That's how quick this job can turn around. And I was going to ask you, with David Poyle stepping down, and technically he is still the GM, I believe, until July 1st. But we all know Barry Trotz is running the team. Who is now the longest tenured GM in the NHL?
Well, that is a fine trivia question. I will now have to go through my mental Rolodex here.
Yep.
I'll
play the Jeopardy theme.
Yeah. How about Don Sweeney in Boston?
He is 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, sixth.
All right.
So if you get a top three, I'll give you a bronze, a silver, and a gold.
Rob Blake in L.A.?
Oh, he is eighth.
Okay. How long has Joe Sakic been in Colorado?
Joe Sakic is not the GM in Colorado anymore.
Oh, that's right. That's right.
Chris McFarland is.
Boy.
Exactly. They won a Stanley Cup recently.
Shovel Dayoff?
Shovel Dayoff gets you a silver medal.
Ooh.
He is second.
Oh, Armstrong?
Doug Armstrong for the St. Louis Blues has been on the job since 2010. The only GM that predated our show was David Poyle from 97. So every GM now on the job was hired while we were doing the show, well after, in fact. So Doug Armstrong is the longest tenured. Kevin Cheveldayoff is second. And the third is Jarmo Kekalainen.
Oh, yes. He has been there, it seems like, forever.
He's been there over 10 years now, and it's time to get results, Jarmo. I would say, I know you got a good relationship with John Davidson, but at some point, we got to see some results on the ice, my friend, for you to keep getting work. But it's amazing when you look at the list and you see Ron Francis, for a second-year franchise, is the 14th longest-tenured GM in the league. It's just amazing how quickly the turnaround is. And then you go to head coaches, and it's no different. You got a lot of head coaches that are brand new, but you know, and we're going to talk about some here in a second. But for the long, you know, the longest-tenured coach in the NHL, right, Eddie?
Is it John Cooper?
That it is. And second is the guy we just talked about, Mike Sullivan. And then Jared Bednar with the Avalanche. So those are your gold, silver, and bronze for them. So not as much turnover there. But even so, if you look at Dave Haxtell, again, the head coach of the Seattle Kraken, who have been around for two whole years, he is 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11, 12th. The 12th longest tenured head coach in the NHL. I mean, that's amazing. He's been two seasons.
Well, we've brought up the Columbus Blue Jackets a couple of times so far in the show. And they are in the news because they have reportedly chosen Mike Babcock as their next head coach, replacing the fired Brad Larsen. Now, the Blue Jackets haven't officially announced that it is Mike Babcock because they are waiting for his contract with Toronto to expire on June the 30th. That deal was an eight-year contract worth $50 million. Babcock is 60 years old. He hasn't worked in the NHL since 2019. He has guided teams to the Stanley Cup final three different times. He won the Stanley Cup with the Red Wings in 2008. He's also guided the Canadian national team to five golds, including two in the Winter Olympics. Was head coach with the Ducks, Red Wings, and Maple Leafs. He has 700 career coaching wins in the NHL over 17 years. Of course, he does come with some baggage. He's been accused by former players of being emotionally and verbally abusive. Former Red Wings forward Johan Franzen said that it was so bad for him that he had a mental breakdown. There was also the Mitch Marner incident, which got a lot of publicity in Toronto, where he asked Mitch Marner to critique his teammates and then later revealed to the teammates what Marner had said about them. And there are other stories as well. Ask Mike Commodore what he thinks of Mike Babcock.
Yeah.
You will talk to you for a long, long time. But, yeah, Mike Babcock, obviously very successful, but, boy, I definitely would not want him as the head coach of my team, but the Blue Jackets don't have a lot of former Stanley Cup winning coaches apparently knocking on their door, so they're going to roll the dice with Mike Babcock. We'll see if he has somehow learned from his mistakes going forward.
It's interesting you phrased it that way because that's been their MO. You think about the Blue Jackets head coaches in the past. And who comes to mind? John Tortorella, head coach or former Stanley Cup champion. Ken Hitchcock, former Stanley Cup champion. So it's not uncommon for them to get these guys that have had success in the past, but it's kind of like it's either this or that. It's either a guy like Ken Hitchcock or John Tortorella or somebody that is brand new, like a Gerard Gallant when he was brand new, Brad Larsen, Todd Richards, those kinds of people. So this one, they go to the veteran hand. And look, the criticism of Babcock is valid, obviously, because he's not refuting it. And the problem I have is that he has shown no growth, no remorse for what he did. It's not like he said, I really got to step away and reevaluate my approach. I got to learn to be a better person, better coach. No, he stepped away because nobody would hire him and because he was a poison pill. And then he said, I'm done coaching in the NHL. Obviously, he wasn't. He wanted to be back behind the bench. And the first opportunity he gets, he takes it. So if I'm a member, if I'm Johnny Gaudreau, I'm pretty upset that I signed a long-term contract with this franchise. And one, the year was a disaster on the ice. And two, my new head coach is Mike Babcock, who's not known for being a player's coach. I mean, when you ask somebody to critique their teammates and it's a young player and he's going to do what the coach wants, so he's not going to say no, and then you read that out, it's absurd. It's absolutely a betrayal of trust, and there's got to be a trusting relationship between player and coach. And Franzen is not alone in the people that have had problems with him and his coaching style. And it's hard to believe a guy that is as tough as Johan Franzen is making it up, is just too soft to play in the NHL, that he needs to toughen up. That's not the way I interpret that. So, as you said, there's quite a few players that have had a problem with him in the past. But to be fair, there's quite a few that have no problem with him whatsoever and liked playing for him. And the guys that won a Stanley Cup under him probably enjoy their Stanley Cup rings and their success. So I understand both sides. I'm with you. I personally, and this is he used to coach the Mighty Ducks back in the day and got us to a Stanley Cup final. I personally would not want him returning to the Ducks. So I wish the Blue Jackets well. I don't think this will go well. I don't think this is going to be a draw for free agents. I think this is going to get them on a lot of no trade clauses of where I don't want to go. You cannot trade me to Columbus because I don't want to play for that rectum. I think that's going to be the case. And I think it's going to make their job harder to build a winner and maybe get the most out of their young players. He's going to have to change his ways. And I don't think we've heard anything that he has done that yet or even thinks he did something wrong. So that's problematic for me when hiring this. And I would question the decision-making of Jarmo Kekäläinen and John Davidson to bring this guy in. Of all the candidates, why this guy? You know, he seems like a guy that was Daryl Sutter the other option? Like what was, I just don't get it. There's got to be a better option out there than this guy, to me, if I'm the Blue Jackets.
Yeah, and look, I'm still pretty old school when it comes to, you know, these types of things. I know we're in a kinder, gentler era, I guess, of how coaches and players have a relationship. But I think you still need to be able to challenge players. I still think you need to be able to, you know, push them. A verbal kick in the behind sometimes is necessary. But that's not really what we're talking about with Mike Babcock. We were talking about a guy who, he didn't have the trust of a lot of his players because he would tell them one thing and do something else or just do little frivolous things. Like we talked about the Trevor Moore thing back in the day. It almost seems like he did things just to show people who's in charge.
Right.
Because he could do it.
And that's remind not what we're people talking what the about. Trevor Moore thing was.
Trevor Moore was playing for the Maple Leafs. He's from Thousand Oaks, California. He had returned to Southern California to play the LA Kings. He was a guy that was kind of in and out of the lineup. And there had just been a shooting, like a real high bubble size shooting in Thousand Oaks. And Mike Babcock decided not to let him play in the game. Just because. I mean, like most coaches, you know, would...
In
would
front of probably, his hometown.
Right. Under all these circumstances, would say, you know what, let's put this guy in the lineup. Maybe he's inspired to play in front of his fans and under the circumstances. And a lot of people were surprised that he didn't let him play. And it seemed like it was basically just because I have the power. I'm going to do this because I want to do this, because I can show you I can do this. That kind of thing. That's what we're talking about. We're not talking about, you know, that we're against coaches being able to be harsh at times when they have to be, because sometimes they do have to be.
Yeah.
But it's just that it's just, but as you said, there also has to be a trust. I think players have always said they don't mind being pushed. They don't mind being challenged. They just want you to be honest about it. You know, if the coach tells you, you do this and you'll be able to play, and then you do it and you don't, then that's, you know, how can you trust that coach? You know, just be upfront. Tell me black and white. What do I need to do to play? What are you expecting of me? Those types of things. And if I don't do it, then you have a right to bench me or to, you know, berate me or whatever. But that's not really what we're talking about with Mike Babcock. It was just the guy that was like on a power trip and loved to kind of flex and do these types of things that just really didn't serve a purpose other than to, I don't know, you know, stroke his own ego or something. I don't know. I have no idea, but
no, you're absolutely right. Of the power trip. And let's go back in time to, and you mentioned the Johan Franzen. Johan Franzen called, if you don't know who he is, he was a guy nicknamed the Mule because he was a hardworking guy in Detroit when they were winning Stanley Cups. Maybe he got the nickname for something else. I don't know. This is a family show. But Johan Franzen was a tough dude, and every player respected his toughness, and every fan
would go. He would go in front of the net and be absolutely beaten by the other teams, and still go back there every time for more.
Yep. Yeah, he was that guy that was the net front presence to get distractions, to get deflections, to screens, whatever. And he called Mike Babcock a terrible man, the worst person I've ever met, and accused Babcock of verbally abusing him, which was corroborated by such softy as Chris Chelios, who was his teammate at the time. And Chris Chelios is a guy that verbally abuses people. And he's like, look, man, I'm a complete rectum, and that guy's out of line. So there's that. We mentioned the Mitch Marner. He said, rank your teammates in order of work ethic, and then shared it with the rest of the team. Hey, this guy, Mitch Marner, this rookie, says you're the laziest person on the team.
Why would you even do that to begin with? That's just so ridiculous. Why did you ask a player to do that?
Why did you have players do book reports? There's different coaching styles for different people. But then we've got, and you mentioned the Trevor Moore. Mike Modano was on the Detroit Red Wings, and he was about to play in his 1,500th game.
I do remember this now, yeah.
And he benched him. Babcock said, no, you're not playing in this game. I'm gonna sit you out. Why? Because he could. Because it's a power trip. Jason Spezza joins the Toronto Maple Leafs. And he's playing, opening night is against his former team, the Ottawa Senators. He scratched him. Didn't let him play in the opening night against his former team. Decided to embarrass him. A veteran player. Anybody ever had a problem with Jason Spezza? Mike Babcock does. He's just a jerk. And he's a jerk because he can be. And that's not the kind of person I would want to play for. That's not the kind of person I want to cheer for as my head coach. And it's the same reason I don't like Daryl Sutter. He looks like a joyless, fornicating rectum. And I don't want that on my team. I don't want that on my bench. And I wouldn't want to play for that guy. And that's how I look at Babcock. So, again, good luck to the Blue Jackets. I don't think it'll end well. I would give this guy 3 years at the most, and he'll be out. And Jarmo Kekalainen, who hired him, might be going with him. But we'll see. It's their hire, their decision, and they have to justify it to their players and their fans.
Well, Doug, your Anaheim Ducks have a head coach. His name is Greg Cronin. He had been previously a coach in the Avalanche organization with their AHL affiliate. He's 60 years old. This is the first time he'll be an NHL head coach. He also coached in the Islanders organization for their AHL affiliate as well. He does have a background in player development. Obviously, the Ducks are looking to rebuild with a lot of younger players, so that certainly seems to fit the mold there. They've got the number two pick of the NHL draft coming up. It is Greg Cronin replacing Dallas Eakins, who was dismissed after four seasons and a record last year of 23-47-12, the worst in the NHL. He takes over a team that missed the playoffs five straight seasons.
Yeah, I said on my on Duck Podcast on Twitter that you know, the usual platitudes of this guy is because I actually saw him coach with the Colorado Eagles. That was the game I went to for the Coachella Valley Firebirds, was against the Colorado Eagles. I had no idea I would have been paying better attention if I thought the Ducks' next head coach was involved. But I saw some people from there say that this is one of the most caring and player-focused guys. And I said, that's great. I don't care. Dallas Eakins was a caring and player-focused person. The team stunk. So here's what I want out of the head coach. Get the most out of the roster and don't be a rectum. That's it. And Dallas Eakins was able to do the second one, could not do the first one. So Greg Cronin, I don't expect you to be, you know, a miracle worker with this roster. It's awful. That's Pat Verbeek's job, is to improve the roster. Your job is to get the most out of the roster you're given and to put in some defensive structure that doesn't get the team outshot 40-23 every night and makes them competitive on a nightly basis. And if you do that, then great. I thought it was an interesting hire only in this regard. The Ducks are not a team that is looking to compete this next season. They're still building through the draft and taking their time, doing things the right way so that when they are ready to compete, they're ready to compete for a long time. Fine. I'm willing to accept that as Pat Verbeek's plan. My problem is this feels like a transitional hire. Greg Cronin is not going to be there when the Ducks are ready to compete because he's 60 right now. You don't hire a 60-year-old man to be your head coach for the next 10 years. You're hiring him to be the coach for the next 3 to 5 years. And so it feels like he's a transitional coach to do exactly what he's done, develop players. He's bringing an almost, and that's what I don't like about it, is he's bringing almost an AHL mentality to the Ducks of, we're just trying to get these guys to be better NHL players. We're trying to get the most out of them. And this is not a development league. This is a professional league where results matter. And the Ducks have torn it down, and they were bad on purpose for the last couple of years, and they probably will be again this coming season. But at some point, there has to be a step towards competitiveness and winning games. And we're not seeing that, I don't think, with Greg Cronin. I just hope there's some defensive structure, some improvement, that the team is more watchable on a game-to-game basis, because it's been rough these last couple of years, seeing them get outplayed on a nightly basis. So I'm willing to give him the benefit of the doubt. Let's see what he can do behind the bench. Let's see what he does in training camp. Pat Verbeek certainly took his time and found the person that he thinks is the right fit. And I'll say this, he's not Mike Babcock. He's not a retread. I'm excited to see what he can do. But as my wife knows as a chef, and as Bill Parcells famously said, if they want you to cook the meal, they ought to let you shop for the groceries. And he's not going to be able to shop for the groceries. He's going to deal with whatever Pat Verbeek gives him, which has been pretty lousy rosters. And I don't think any coach in the NHL could get the Ducks into the playoffs or being a competitive team with what they've had to work with in recent years. And I'm hoping that takes some steps towards fixing that this summer. But so far, nothing yet. And we've seen some moves. We've seen some roster moves from some teams, and the Ducks are still sitting on their hands. But they have a head coach now. Let's see what he can do.
There are two head coaching vacancies still yet to be filled, the Calgary Flames and the New York Rangers. I have not heard too many names thrown out there for Calgary. I saw Travis Green, the former Canucks coach's name, got thrown out there. I don't know how serious that is.
He was a finalist for the Ducks job as well.
For the Rangers, though, they asked permission to talk with former Predators head coach John Hines. We've heard Peter Laviolette. There was a rumor about maybe Patrick Roy, who just apparently won the Memorial Cup, and that was apparently shot down. So we shall see. Two more coaching vacancies still yet to be filled in the NHL.
Yep. And it's amazing that we have Babcock, Spencer Carberry, Andrew Burnett, Greg Cronin. Those are the new head coaches so far. Rick Tocchet took over midseason. And then the Rangers and Flames. And of those teams, the only one that made the playoffs last year is the Rangers, correct?
Correct.
So it is interesting that the Rangers' job would be the most desirable, you would think, because they're ready to win right now. But they obviously expect the most as well. We expect to win right now.
There was a major signing this week. Montreal Canadiens agreed to terms in an 8-year extension with forward Cole Caulfield. Deal will pay him $7.85 million per season. He's 22 years old, had 26 goals and 10 assists in 46 games last year before having season-ending shoulder surgery. Led the Canadiens in goals for a second straight year, although he was tied with Nick Suzuki this season. Before surgery, Caulfield was ranked 11th in the NHL in goals scored. Since making his NHL debut in 2020-21, he's recorded 84 points, 53 goals, 31 assists, and 123 games. He's ranked second in the NHL among players drafted in 2019 with in goals scored with 53, behind only Jack Hughes, the first overall pick for the New Jersey Devils. Caulfield was a first-round pick, 15th overall, by the Canadiens in 2019.
I love this signing for Cole Caulfield, and I think for the long term, I'll give you two reasons why this is a great deal for him and why it's a great deal for the team. First, for him, I think the salary cap is going to go down in the near future, and we'll talk about that in a second. And so him getting his money while he can is very wise and locked in. And for the Canadiens, I think $7.85 million is going to look like a bargain for a guy of his skill and his productivity in a few years. So they're going to look at this and be like, how are we paying this guy less than $8 million a year? This is amazing. And we got him locked up through his prime years. So a very good deal for both sides. Well done by the Canadiens getting him for the full 8 years. Kent Hughes, well done by him on that one. But for Cole Caulfield, how do you turn down $62.8 million?
You don't.
No, exactly. So thank you very much. I can't wait to get to work. Let me know when camp starts. I'll be there. If you'll excuse me, I have to go shopping. I'm going to go get everything I ever wanted. And
that would be fun.
Yeah. And call up your friends and, hey, boys, we're going shopping. Let's go, man. It's on me today. Yeah, that would be fun. So what would be the most, let me get into that before we get into a little off topic report. What would be the most frivolous thing you would buy for yourself, Eddie, knowing that you're now in your middle age and you're a little bit more conservative with lifestyle and you're married and all that? What's the most frivolous thing you would buy yourself if you were if you got that kind of a contract or won the lottery?
Well, frivolous is an interesting term. To me, frivolous is something that really doesn't serve any purpose, but it's something you would like to have.
Yeah, it's just something you would like to have.
It would be some piece of sports memorabilia, probably, like the jersey from Franco Harris for the Immaculate Reception.
Oh, my.
Or a Roberto Clemente authentic bat or something like that. Something that really, it's just to look at. There's nothing, it's not like buying a car that's going to get you from here to there or do anything like that. Just that would be my, something really.
You wouldn't want a Star Wars prop?
Yeah, that could be good. That could be good, yeah.
This is Han Solo's blaster?
Yeah, that would be cool. Absolutely.
I would think, because I've always wanted these, and if I signed that contract, I would immediately be like, okay, when the money hits my bank account, let me know. I want all the Guns N' Roses pinball machines, full-size, hooked up, in my house, ready to go.
How many would that be, a ballpark?
Three.
Oh, that's not too bad. No, that's actually, three. I mean, at least you get some entertainment value out of that. It's something you can actually, take part in playing.
Right.
Instead of something you're just looking at. So.
No, but I mean, you would enjoy having those items, but the first thing is like, I want that set up ready to play. I'd have an arcade in my house and, 100%, like the old school arcade where I could go in and just flip it on like Silver Spoons and just have fun and be a kid.
There's a timely reference. Yeah.
Yeah. If you understand that reference, what time is it, Eddie? It's time for your colonoscopy. But let's get to there's a reason I said the salary cap is going to go down. Yes. And I think you're going to bring that up in the near future.
We had a three-team trade earlier today involving the Kings, Flyers, and Blue Jackets. And interesting, the Kings love making deals with those two teams. Do the Ducks have a partner that they like to do business with over the years? Is there something that comes to mind? I don't know how often this is with certain teams, but the Kings and Blue Jackets and Flyers seem to love doing business together, even though for Philadelphia, it's not the same guy. It's not still Dean Lombardi and so on and so forth. But anyway, the Kings sent goalie Cal Peterson, defenseman Sean Walker, defensive prospect Helga Granz, and a 2024 second round pick to Philadelphia. The Flyers sent defenseman Ivan Provorov to the Kings, who then sent him to the Blue Jackets while retaining 30% of his salary. The Flyers also get first and second round picks from Columbus in 2023. And the first rounder they got from Columbus, ironically, came from the Kings at the trade deadline when they acquired Vladislav Gavrikov and Jonas Korpisalo. The Kings also get a couple of AHL players in Kevin Connaughton and Hayden Hodgson. But according to CapFriendly.com, the reason the Kings did this is they now have $13.2 million in salary cap space as they are looking to re-sign defenseman Vladislav Gavrikov, who they acquired at the trade deadline. So the Flyers are picking up assets. They're taking on a player like Cal Peterson, who the Kings are thrilled to be out from under that contract. Ivan Provorov goes to the Blue Jackets because they wanted help on defense. So all in all, everyone happy, I would think, after this deal.
Yeah, I think all three teams are very happy with what they got. The Flyers are starting a tear down. They need assets. They need prospects. And they're the ones that ended up with Walker, correct?
Correct.
Yeah, so I think they got a good defenseman. You would know better than me, but I think they got a good defenseman that can play NHL minutes right now, certainly.
Yes, he can be a third pairing guy.
As they continue to transition from being a playoff contender on paper to starting the rebuild for real. The Kings absolutely got out from underneath the contract of both Walker. They needed to free up some space on their defense because of the number of prospects they had. Brant Clark is probably coming in next season.
The prospects they gave up is a right shot defenseman, and they have more than they can use at this point. As you mentioned, Brant Clark, Jordan Spence, all these guys are in line before Helga Grant. So they gave up a prospect who could have an NHL future, but there's no room for him. So you're giving up a prospect from a position of strength.
And remind me of his name, but they gave up a guy to the Wild as well.
Oh, yes, they did. Brock Faber. Yeah.
Yeah. So it's like they were so deep that they're giving out guys and they still have a lot of options as at that position. The key, though, for the Kings is obviously Gavrikov. If they're not able to sign him, then this is a mystery move. But I guess you're freeing up space for those guys, the young prospects. But I have to think they have a deal in place or are close to it with Gavrikov.
You would think so. You would think so, yes.
But there's no reason not to announce it. They can go over the cap right now. You know, they have to be cap compliant by the end of the offseason, not the beginning of it. So no reason if they have one in place to not do it. And Gavrikov holds all the cards because he can be a very highly sought after free agent if he decides he wants to hear what all 32 teams have to say next month. But I would think they have a deal very close and will announce that in the days to come. So a good trade for the Kings, who don't suffer anything on the ice. Cal Peterson was not playing for them. Walker will be easily replaced by one of their prospects, and Gavrikov coming back for a full season would be a great boon to their defensive depth and ability as well. And then does that free up, and you follow the, again, Locked On LA Kings, folks, for all your daily Kings news. Where does this stand with signing Korpisalo?
I think that they will want to get the Gavrikov thing finalized and see, obviously, what's left. But I still think that is an option to bring Korpisalo back.
Because they still have to re-sign Gabe Vilardi as well.
But I'd expect maybe some kind of a bridge deal for him.
A one-year deal.
And take care of him next season.
And this is the beginning of the offseason. You know, they're not done making moves. They've shown that they can make They could even send out another defenseman if they wanted to.
Yeah.
And still have plenty of good depth if they're able to re-sign Gavrikov. So lots of options. Well done by Rob Blake to get out from under the Cal Peterson contract, which he never should have signed in the first place.
I agree with that as well. But how about Danny Briere's first move as Flyers
Danny Briere, GM? I mean, look, it's for the Flyers, I'm not in love with it, but because I have to see the other shoe has to drop. Clearing these deals are easy to make. You and I could make this trade if we were Danny Briere. You're weaponizing your cap space. You're getting rid of a guy that you no longer wanted on your team in Ivan Provorov, and you've been trying to deal for a while now. And, okay, we got some assets in return. But what do we do with that? That's the other shoe to drop. And it's not just what did we get in this trade. It's what are you going to do with what you got? And so that's what I need to see. And when I do see that, then we'll be able to kind of evaluate, okay, that was well done. That was a good move. Because if he's got Cal Peterson, Sean Walker, and Sean Walker's a good player. I don't know anything about Helga Granz. I don't know if he's going to be a quality player or not. But ultimately, you got Sean Walker and a second-round pick. Now, you did get a first-round pick from Columbus, so you got a lot of assets. So 2 seconds, a conditional one there. And a first, but you have to make good use of those or else it's a wash and you got Ivan Provorov for nothing. But for the Blue Jackets, I like it. They got to improve their NHL roster, and they did. Ivan Provorov makes them better than they were yesterday. So I think all three teams are in a better position. The onus now is on the Flyers and Danny Briere to make good use of those assets that he got. But he got a good return for Ivan Provorov. I have to say that. A first, 2 seconds, and an NHL caliber player for Ivan Provorov is outstanding return for him in the offseason. So well played by him.
Future Hall of Famer and free agent forward Patrick Kane will be shelved 4 to 6 months after undergoing a hip resurfacing procedure. The 34-year-old played out the final 19 games of an 8-year, $84 million deal with the Rangers last season. Of course, they got him from the Blackhawks on February 28th. He had played 1,161 games in a Chicago sweater before the trade. He's going to be a free agent on July 1st. He had 12 points for the Rangers in just 57 games. His lowest output since the 2012-2013 season. He's a 9-time All-Star, 3-time Stanley Cup winner, number one overall pick in 2007. He has won a Calder Trophy, Conn Smythe Trophy, Hart Trophy, scoring title. So certainly a future Hall of Famer, as we said, Patrick Kane. But where he goes from here will be interesting, and how this surgery affects him will be interesting as well.
Well, I would think this is almost, and for those of you that are not in North America or NFL fans, it's going to be, I'll explain it a little bit, but I think this almost makes him like the Odell Beckham of the NHL. Why not take your time and rehab and not sign any deal this summer, not sign any deal at the beginning of the season, and when you're fully healthy, then go out and kind of audition yourself to NHL teams and say, hey, I'm inviting representatives to a workout. I'm going to show you what I can do. And then let's see. Now I see what the standings look like. I see how where your roster is. Maybe you had an injury that you didn't expect. And what's the best fit for me on a short-term basis? And I'll take a one-year deal to try and go in and help a team. I think that's the best. He doesn't need the money. He's set for life. So he's not like, man, I need the income. I need to sign with somebody right now. I think that's where I would do. And Odell Beckham did that in the NFL. It worked out very well for him. He got paid very well. And I think Patrick Kane could do that to his benefit and maybe sign in January with a team for the second half of the season.
Oh, that's an interesting thought. Interesting thought. See if he does that. Remember the story about Avalanche forward Valeri Nichushkin back in April during the playoffs? Police were called to the team hotel in Seattle where they were facing the Kraken. There was an intoxicated woman there who ended up being taken to the hospital. Nichushkin did not end up playing the rest of the season. Now, no charges were brought against him. Police had body cam video footage that was released this week. It didn't really show much, but you did hear a lot of conversations between the police and the Avalanche security personnel that gave some details on the situation. Nichushkin, I think if you're going to look at some some diciness involved in this was kind of whisked away from the hotel before the police arrived. So he was not available to be questioned by them. Again, it wasn't, they were called because there was a disturbance going on between Nikushkin and this woman. And again, both were apparently intoxicated. The woman apparently wasn't injured, although she was treated and taken to a hospital because she was very intoxicated. She had been making some comments about Nikushkin taking her passport. So there was some implication that maybe he was holding her against her will in some way. But again, no charges were ever filed against Nikushkin. And Deputy Commissioner Bill Daley did say this week, I guess they had before the game, one of the final, Gary Bettman and Bill Daley, you know, had their annual State of the League address or whatever it is before the final. He said that the incident has been handled and it was handled appropriately. And the league knows what happened, and Nikushkin is not facing any punishment over this. He will be eligible to play at the start of next season.
Look, we don't know what happened here. And when you're dealing with people that are intoxicated,
they don't know what happened.
Exactly. And they're not in control of their own actions. And it sounds like, who knows? But if what I want to believe happened is Nikushkin and this lady were having a great time, drinking, maybe doing some drugs, having themselves a ball, spent the night together, wake up, moods have changed, the light of day, things look different, and she's upset, he's upset, they have a fight, police get called, they're both still intoxicated, and things get said that may or may not be true. If the investigation was done, and body cam footage and all that stuff, and you've done a complete investigation and you've determined that nothing was done illegally to the point of kidnapping or false imprisonment or human trafficking or any of that stuff, then great. If it's just two intoxicated people having an argument, I can live with that. But the NHL just does not have the benefit of the doubt that their investigation is worth anything. I mean, it's just an absolute rubber stamp, nothing to see here, move on, as far as I'm concerned. So, yeah, I don't believe that they did their due diligence, and I want to, but I don't. So, hope he's going to be back, and we're all going to forget this, and it is what it is.
Finally, we did have the NHL reveal the two Stadium Series games coming up next season. They are both at the same place on back-to-back days. MetLife Stadium in New Jersey. Flyers at Devils, February 17th. Rangers versus Islanders on February 18th.
No comment. That ship has sailed of me being excited about that. Are you going to have news about your Kings broadcasts?
We can talk about it if you like. I wasn't going to bring it up, but
I do want to bring it up because, one, you did a great show on it yesterday on your Locked On LA Kings. I listened to that on my podcast on the way home. Helped to keep me from killing myself as I crossed the grapevine at 3 a.m. But I think it's relevant to the NHL at large. So why don't you get into what happened, and then I'll talk about why I think it's relevant.
The LA Kings announced that they were not renewing the contract of their number one TV play-by-play man, Alex Faust, who is a very talented young broadcaster who's done network games for the NHL. He's done college football. He's a guy whose star is rising in the broadcasting world. But the reason they're doing this is because they're cutting costs. They're consolidating their broadcast crew. They're going to do a simulcast of radio and TV. The old radio guy, Nick Nixon, is going to be doing the TV call. Jim Fox will still be the color analyst. But the reason they're doing this is because the regional sports network situation is completely up in the air. I mentioned that the San Diego Padres in baseball, who were, you know, their contract with Bally Sports has been basically voided because Bally Sports was not paying them the money that they were owed to broadcast the games. So the Padres are now offering their games streaming for a fee. I think it's $20 a month. And with these regional sports networks, or the regional sports network, Bally Sports, going belly up, there's a lot of professional teams out there Just for example, in Southern California, you got the Kings, Ducks, Clippers, Angels, Padres. Most teams don't have their own networks like, you know, the Yankees and the Dodgers and the Lakers and things like that. So with these dominoes starting to fall, there's going to be interesting decisions going forward as to where games in the NHL will be broadcast next season for a lot of teams and how you're going to have to pay to watch them for next season.
Right. And so the reason I think this is relevant to the NHL as a whole is exactly what I was talking about earlier. I think the salary cap is going to go down because TV money from American markets is disappearing. And you're basically going to be giving away the product and trying to get people to pay. So the market, for those that don't know here in the United States, what it was is the regional sports networks were very fat for about 30 years. And so you had a network like, let's say, let's just use us for an example so that we're not getting into any details or trying to get any problems. The Puck Podcast Network. And we got the rights to broadcast the Kings games here in Southern California. Now, it wasn't just Kings games. We also had the Lakers for a time, and we had the Dodgers for a time, and everybody watched our network because we had the local sports. And every cable and satellite subscriber in Los Angeles, which is a massive market in the Los Angeles area, every one of them paid us every single month, whether they ever watched our network or not. So let's say we had the Puck Podcast Network and we had it up and running here in Los Angeles, and there were 10 million subscribers to cable and satellite, and we got $5 from every one of them every month. $50 million a month we got. And so we could spend lucratively on rights deals for those teams and those leagues to keep that money going. And we would raise the rate. Now it's $5.50 a month. Now it's $6 a month. And every single person, whether they wanted to or not, paid us that money every month. Didn't matter if they watched your network or not. Now, that money has been disappearing slowly over years because of streaming. So instead of 10 million subscribers, now there's 4 million subscribers. And they're still paying.
And now you also have, oh, look, the Dodgers are making their own network. The Lakers are making their own network.
Right.
So take
those cherries off the tree, and now you still have the Kings and Clippers, whoopity-doo. Nobody's paying big money to see those teams because they're paying big money to see the Kings and the Dodgers, or the Lakers and the Dodgers with their own networks. So, yeah, Ducks, Angels, Clippers, Kings. Ooh, I can't wait to pay. Nobody's saying that. And the rates have gone up exponentially over those 30 years to where it's now $9 a month, $10 a month, and more people are opting out. So instead of having $50 million a month, you're now making, let's say, $30 million a month, maybe $25 million a month. But your rates, the rights to pay to get those teams have gone up. And that's where, look, Sinclair, whoever bought them from Fox Sports was an absolute moron. They way overpaid. They went out of business within 5 years. It was a joke. So with that eroding and completely gone now for, as you'd mentioned, it's not just the NHL, it's the NBA and MLB as well. But there's a lot of American teams that are now without a regional sports provider. And I have no idea what the Ducks are going to do for this coming season, but they've already made their cuts by getting rid of the color commentator on the radio and the pre and post game show on the radio. So that was their cuts. They haven't touched the TV broadcast to my knowledge, but they cut on radio. Kings decided to cut on TV, not radio, which is an interesting decision, but that's their thing. So the reason I think the salary cap is going to go down is the Penguins, the Lightning, the Panthers, the Kings, the Stars, the Blues, all these teams were contributing money into the revenue by getting rights deals with these local affiliates that are no longer paying them. And they're going to be replaced by things that are far less lucrative. The Kings are looking at KCOP, which is a local over-the-air broadcast network, which is how it was when I was a kid. 40 years ago, games were broadcast on your antenna, and you'd watch games, and it was great. And I hope they go back to that because I think it'll make the popularity of the sport, it's more accessible. Fans will be able to watch the product. They'll be more invested in the team. Merchandise and ticket sales would go up as a result. But the team is not going to get the lucrative money that they were from the regional sports broadcast. So as a league, the revenue is going to go down in the coming years because of the collapse of the regional sports business model. And they're going to have to figure out a new model. And whatever it is, if you want to replace, so let's say they do have a streaming service and they say, we want people to pay X amount per month to watch the Kings games. You'd have to charge a lucrative amount to get back the $50 million a month you were making. And there are not enough Kings fans in the world to do that. So no matter how, this is now the proof of the pudding. They were thinking for a long time, look how popular our sport is. Look how popular our team is. Now you're going to find out who's actually willing to pay to watch your product. And it's going to be far less than you thought it was. Far less than was the case. Because who's going to pay to watch the Ducks on a monthly basis? I'm not. If they're on free TV, I'll watch it. If you want me to pay $20 a month, get a better product on the ice and let's talk. I'm not paying to watch an AHL team. So there's a day of reckoning coming, and I think it's here for the NHL. And I think the salary cap is going to shrink in the years to come as a result of the lack of revenue. And this is not a ha-ha, the Kings are being put on local TV. Ha-ha, the Ducks, whatever. No, it's a league problem. And it's going to affect all teams. The Maple Leafs are going to have less money to spend on their roster because the Kings aren't on Valley Sports whatever anymore. And that's the reality of it. And I think it's going to affect all teams. Now, what the Kings' decision was, I think was very short-sighted. I think it's ridiculous that they're still paying Mike Richards $700,000 a year, but they can't put on a good TV broadcast. And to me, I would control your own message. Launch the Kings TV network. I think what they should do is the Kings and Ducks should partner up and launch a SoCal hockey channel that broadcasts both games, both teams, as much as possible with pre- and post-game shows and stuff like that that airs on KCOP or on KTLA, a local channel. You know what I mean? Partner up, make it one network that we're sharing the costs of production, we're sharing the costs of promotion, and we have one home for both teams that have their own broadcast feel and crews. But we'll see what they do. It's going to be very interesting to see in these years to come.
Time for the third and final period here on the Puck Podcast. We got some emails to get to, but first we want to thank all of our wonderful supporters on Patreon. It is patreon.com/puckpodcast. If you would like to join the group that supports the show, we very much appreciate it. And thank you to all of our Patreon supporters. We also want to give a shout out to our friend Dave at Tally Hockey Jerseys, tallycustomhockeyjerseys.com. You can go there to the Puck Podcast team store, get you some Puck Podcast merchandise, jerseys, hats, all that kind of stuff. We would appreciate your support of the show and of our friend Tim as well. Dave. My goodness.
Old school.
Dave at tallyhockeyjersey.com. Yeah, I'm thinking of our guy Tim O'Neill back in the day. Let's get to the emails, Doug. We've got two from Matt Keisler. I guess we'll split them up. You want to read one? I'll read the other one.
Sure. Let's start with this first one, which was about Bruce Cassidy and the Bruins. Not to be confused with Sean Cassidy and the Hardy Boys.
Oh, boy.
What's wrong?
Nothing.
Hey, guys. I wanted to take exception to Doug's comments that the Bruins are regretting firing Bruce Cassidy. While Cassidy is definitely a great coach, his style is one that is unsustainable for long periods of time. The Bruins made the Stanley Cup final in his second full season as head coach. After that, you saw a slow regression on the team despite a ton of talent. Winding up with the 2021-22 season where Krejci did not play, DeBrusk wanted to be traded, and Pastrnak wasn't sure he wanted to sign a long-term deal. All of those issues were related to Cassidy's coaching style. Had he stayed, I think Bergeron retired, Krejci doesn't return, DeBrusk holds fast to his trade demand, and Pastrnak decides to test free agency. A Bruins team missing those guys probably does not even make the playoffs. While the results in this postseason sucked, and yes, Montgomery made some costly errors, had Cassidy still been coaching, I doubt that they are even in that position since the team had tuned him out long ago. It would have been more Sutter in Calgary versus what we're seeing in Vegas. Cassidy's hard-ass coaching style will be good for Vegas for a while, but it won't last. Knights fans need to hope they win their cup this year or next, as I think they only have a 2 or 3 year window before you see the same issues appear in Boston appear in Vegas. And I will say this before you get to his next email, Eddie. I can see both sides being the case, that Cassidy is a great coach and that it just was not a good fit with the Bruins anymore. It's no different than a divorce. If you're not right in that marriage, that doesn't mean you're a horrible person and you're not a good fit for somebody else. It means you weren't a good fit in that marriage. And that marriage had to end in order for you to go on and be in a successful marriage somewhere else. So it's no different. And it ended. It ran its course in Boston. Both sides were to blame or had problems, but ultimately it just wasn't a good fit anymore. And it's a great fit for him in Vegas, and they had a good season under Jim Montgomery. So I think both sides are happy with what they have, but it was a time to move on and doesn't mean either side was ultimately bad or to blame. It just wasn't a good fit anymore.
Well, apparently Matt had a lot of time on his hands because he sent another email in as well. Was it the same day? I think, yeah, in the same day. He sent two emails in the same day. This guy is...
An hour later.
He says, I know I already sent you guys a message this week about Bruce Cassidy, but I've been thinking about something else surrounding the playoffs overall. It seems like every year we get a ton of amazing first-round series, followed by a bunch of duds for the remaining rounds. Occasionally we'll get a competitive cup final, but there have only been 2 7-game finals in the past 14 years, both involving my Bruins. Obviously something needs to change, but since Gary Bettman thinks this format is the greatest thing ever, it will have to wait until he's gone and I'm elected the new NHL commissioner. Well, that certainly, I'm sure, will happen at any moment. He says, as a benevolent dictator in my role, I will institute several tweaks to our great game that will make it even better. He says, besides the implementation of the gold standard for the draft and the elimination of the offsides reviews, my biggest change will be in the calculation of standings and playoff seedings. Folks, we are going for an international soccer scoring system for the regular season. 3 points for a regulation win, 2 points for an overtime win, 1 point for a tie. Yes, ties are back because the shootout is a stupid skills contest that does nothing but artificially inflate the standings as reflected by the overall standings change noted below. Well, Matt, you've already lost me, but we'll continue. Once the season is over, we're going to seed teams 1 through 16 with the 4 division winners getting seeds 1 through 4. For the playoffs, with reseeding based on record every round after division wins only matter in round one. Doing some math on the 2022-23 season, I have attached a spreadsheet to show my work converting all the shootout results into ties. The same 16 teams make the playoffs under this system, but we have 3 different division winners. The Devils win the Metro by 3 points over the Canes, Dallas wins the Central by a single point over Colorado, and the Oilers run away with the Pacific with a 10-point cushion over the Golden Knights. And the playoff races aren't very competitive either, with the Penguins snagging the final seed by 7 points over Buffalo. Calgary, Pittsburgh, and Nashville aren't even in the discussion in this exercise, as their records were wildly inflated with overtime and shootout losses. As for the playoff matchups, unfortunately, my Bruins still face the Panthers, and Colorado still faces Seattle, but all the others are different. Colorado versus Seattle is an 8-9 matchup given their true records, so the Seattle results this spring shouldn't be surprising. So he's got Florida versus Boston, Edmonton versus the Islanders, New Jersey against Minnesota, Dallas against Winnipeg, Toronto versus LA, Carolina versus Tampa Bay, Vegas versus New York Rangers, Colorado versus Seattle. This format would be so much better and I think would create way better matchups in the later rounds. Florida probably still climbs up the ladder, but would Vegas having to face a much tougher Rangers team in the first round? Unfortunately, we'll never know. Thank you for your consideration. I appreciate your support in my quest to fix the NHL. That is Matt in San Diego. I will never be in favor of ties under any circumstances. So, like I said, you've lost me if you're bringing ties back, because I hate ties like I hate some vegetables.
Which vegetables?
I don't know. Rutabaga? Beets?
Those come up pickles. A lot. Rutabaga?
I don't know. It's just the first thing that popped in my head. Never even had it.
I remember my dad being at a restaurant not that long ago, maybe 20 years ago, and him being asked, you know, what are the vegetables today? We have this, we have that, we have this, we have Swiss chard. And he's like, Swiss chard what? No, no, sir, that's the name of the vegetable. Oh, well, I've never heard of it, so no. but yeah, that's, let's move on to my next email, which is from Jim the German. He says, gentlemen, I hope both of you are well and Eddie's TV is alive once again. Any update on your TV, Eddie?
That will be on next week's show.
I have a coach comment question or two. I don't agree with your opinion on Coach Rod Brind'Amour. Brind'Amour proved again this year that he cannot adjust his team's play in the playoffs. But the real reason I can't respect Brind'Amour is that he sat back and watched his head coach hit and kick players while he was an assistant coach. He even admitted that once the information became public knowledge. How can I trust him to have my back when he does that? The real coach I wish to write about is Ron Wilson. Should Coach Wilson be inducted into the Hockey Hall of Fame or not as an innovator? Isn't he the man that introduced tablets to the bench when he was the coach for San Jose? I remember this show discussing it when he started and how it was an advantage. It must be as almost every team, sorry, Philly, has tablets on the bench these days. That is Jim the German, and I did not know I'd forgotten at least that he was the one. It would be interesting to call him an innovator because that is certainly prevalent in every team, and only Tortorella, who hates technology and all things fun, would. It's that's interesting. I don't know that it's Hall of Fame worthy, but it's certainly recognition worthy of maybe a Ron Wilson sticker on the back of every tablet. So you see his smiling face.
I had totally forgotten about that as well. So good job by Jim to remember that.
Jim says, P.S. Eddie, you are getting better at reading foreign languages. I ask the Puck Podcast community to write in using their native languages so Eddie can continue his talents. I agree with that.
That's not necessary.
Wholeheartedly. That's not necessary. Why are we waiting a week on the TV?
Well, because I had to update the situation with the motion sickness. And we're getting a new TV Thursday, and I guess I'll let the cat out of the bag. We're going to be cord cutters as well.
Uh-huh.
Yep.
Well, I heard that you let the cat out of the bag on your Locked On LA Kings. But welcome to the party, pal.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Bruce Willis.
You're going to it's a much better life.
We'll see.
You're going to save hundreds of dollars a month, thousands of dollars a year, and you're already subscribing to all those things. So it's not that, you'll pick and choose. Yeah. But anyway, we'll go over all that next week when you talk about it. But you're getting a brand new TV?
On Thursday,
yeah. Very good.
Yep. Our next email comes from Bob, and Bob is down there San Diego way, just like old Matt Geisler. And he says, hey, fellas, longtime listener here. Love the show, the Puck Podcast community, and everyone's comments. Just wanted to chime in on your last show's comment about how our teams fared this year and our thoughts about the playoff finals as a Bruins fan. Wow, he's another Bruins fan from San Diego. I couldn't be more disappointed and have almost gotten over the shock and sadness. For the past six seasons or so, I consider the Panthers my girlfriend team. And after this year's disappointing early exit from my wife team, the Bruins, I am not rooting for my girlfriend team. I am bitter, just like they have had all the good team and no fan support. Apart from underperforming, they are still likable and may have figured out the right combination and missing pieces. I am a fan of Keith Tkachuk and stood by him throughout his career in spite of all the shenanigans, but I am not going to give into Matthews' antics. My bracket was busted after round one, and both of my final picks were toast. Well, you're definitely not the only one there. My choice is Vegas, with Bruce Cassidy being sent unceremoniously packing by Boston, even though they had a record-breaking year. I believe we would all trade that for a cup. To quote Marchand, said 82 wins don't mean anything if you can't win 16. Patrice Bergeron is my favorite player, and he's the best example of what a true hockey player is. I am heartbroken to see him retire. Looking forward to the return to the Puck Podcast hockey game. Our team, the Bruce Brothers, who play at Poway Ice, the practice facility for the Gulls, won their first championship, and it was due in large part to getting new Tally hockey jerseys. Yeah.
There you go.
Thanks for all you guys do. And he included a picture of the team with their fake cup and their Tally hockey jersey. It looks like it's kind of hard to make out because it is a picture I can't really zoom in on, but it looks like they do have some sort of Blues Brothers type of logo there on the front. The team, though, the Bruise Brothers, B-R-E-W-S.
Ooh, I see what they did there.
Yeah.
Well, very good.
Thank you, Bob.
Love hearing about the support of... Yeah, I see the pictures there. Fantastic. Good looking. You don't got to spend a lot on hair product for that team, man.
Wow. There was no need for that.
I'm just saying. I see 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 men that are completely bald at least. That's all.
Yeah, they could invest in the no play for Mr. Gray on that team as well. They got a lot of gray beards going
There's
on.
There's not one person that's clean shaven, is there? Oh, yeah, there's the guy on the top.
Guy in the middle
the top
there?
Right yeah. there, those four. Yeah, the youngsters. But, yeah, no, that is a that's a nice, that's a good feeling to win that and feel good. Good for you guys. Our next email comes from our friend Pete down in Adelaide. And I've met him. And good man, Pete. And I always like hearing from him. So let's see what he has to say. Dear Doug and Eddie, I'll be brief. Here are some very short letters which I would like to send in regarding the NHL. Number one, dear NHL broadcasters, I know money is great, but please stop those fake scrolling ads on the boards. They look more like 94 Sega Genesis than live hockey in 2023. Sincerely irritated viewers. Number two, dear Vegas Golden Knights, please resist the urge to put on your Golden Knight on an actual horse in the pregame show. I know you've thought about it, and I can assure you it would not end well. Sincerely, animal lovers everywhere. Putting, yeah, an actual horse on the ice would be poor. Number three, dear Matthew Tkachuk, please stop chewing on your mouth guard. It's disgusting. And if you get a puck to the mouth, you'll probably lose many teeth. On second thought, never mind. Sincerely, everyone watch. Number four, dear security guard at the Honda Center, thank you for letting me into the Ducks-Kings game when I arrived with my backpack. We don't know any better. Sincerely, a clueless Australian. And finally, number five, dear Doug and Eddie, thank you for all the years of service. I've been a listener as long as Lucy Liu. Oh, bye. Well, if she is a longtime listener, she's probably got a restraining order on me. Sincerely, Pete Johns, Adelaide, South Australia. So thank you for that, Pete. And I like those little fortune cookie style memos to different people around the league. Thank you for that.
Our next email comes from George Winning, and he is in the Netherlands, not Netherlands, the Netherlands. That's the only country I can think of that puts the in front. But anyway, for those of you,
it's like the Ohio State.
Yeah, it is like the Ohio State
University. The Netherlands.
For those of you who said that hockey wouldn't work in the desert, I guess you're wrong. With the Golden Knights taking commanding 2-0 lead in the Stanley Cup Finals, and over in the AHL, my Coachella Valley Firebirds have just reached the Calder Cup Final. I guess it is possible to play hockey in the sand. Comments like these are made through either jealousy from fans whose own teams have been utter garbage for the past couple of decades, or through climate change activists who don't believe a hockey rink should be built anywhere. Anyway, back to the hockey talk. Before the start of the finals, I predicted that it would go a full 7 games, with all besides the last being won by the home team. In Game 7, the Panthers would clinch it in overtime with a world-class goal from Matthew Tkachuk. So far, so good for my prediction, even though I now believe that the classy play of Vegas will overrule the dirty play by Florida. But no matter which way it goes, the winning team will be cheering and drinking out of the cup with sand between their toes. Maybe these teams are onto something. Should the thin layer of ice be replaced by sand? And should the name be changed to sand hockey? Just a thought. Anyway, I hope this email finds you both well and that you're both enjoying the hockey. I can tell that the off season is approaching due to the longer off-ice reports filled with utter randomness and nonsense, just the way we like it. This email has definitely gone on way too long, and I now need to rush back to pack my hockey bag and head to the rink. Thanks, guys. And for this week, go Firebirds. That is George Winning in Dordrecht, the Netherlands. And he's a Coachella Valley Firebird fan in the Netherlands. All right.
Man, George, I wish I had known that. I had 2 Firebirds hats. I went on hat night. And I ended up giving them away to people that probably will not appreciate them nearly as much as you would have. So, damn. If I get more gear from out there, I will definitely procure it for you. So send your sizes and let me know. Next up, is Ben the biggest Sabres fan in Pittsburgh? And we still don't know if that means he is the largest human physically or just a
he is not.
The biggest fan.
I've met him a couple of times. No, he's not a big guy. He's a regular sized man.
Well, he could be, but the other one could be a little person.
All right, fine.
There you go. So, hello, Doug and Eddie. I hope both of you are and your respective families are doing well. By the time you read this email, the Stanley Cup Finals will be well underway. Indeed, they are. This year, I am renaming the Stanley Cup Finals to a competition between former Sabres players to win a large trophy, as there are 7 former Sabres in this year's finals. Without cheating, can you guys name all 7? Best regards, Ben. Have you looked at this email, Ed?
No, I have not.
All right.
Does he have a list on
yes,
there?
Yes, he does. Can you name the 7 former Sabres competing in this year's final?
Are you going to help me with this? I don't think I can do this by... I know I can't do this by myself.
Well, I have the list in front of me, so...
Oh, well, that's unfortunate. Jack Eichel, obviously.
That's one.
Boy. Going through the Florida Panthers... roster in my brain here. Sam Reinhart?
That is 2. Well done.
Oh, boy. Brandon Montour?
3. Well done. I'll be surprised.
How many?
There's 4 more.
Are there any more Panthers?
Yes.
Oh, boy.
He was with the Sabres briefly. Veteran player, now a journeyman.
Nick Cousins?
Nope. He's from a family of hockey players.
Oh, well. One of the Stahl brothers? I don't remember them being on the Sabres. Was Eric Stahl on the Sabres?
Bing.
Oh, my. I do not remember that.
And now the others are on, I believe. One of these guys I don't think has played all season. Casey Fitzgerald. Let's throw that out.
Oh, well, thank God, because I never would have got that.
Yeah. So the other 2 are on the Golden Knights. And I believe one of them is also a former King.
Braden McNabb?
That is correct.
Oh, wow.
And this last one, his name is also the name of a naval ship.
Huh. Oh, it's got to be the SS White Cloud.
Oh, unfortunately, no.
It's
not pronounced the same, but it's spelled the same as a naval ship.
Theodore?
Huh?
Shea Theodore? Shea Theodore?
Theodore?
Yeah, I don't know.
Carrier. Aircraft carrier. William Carrier.
Oh, I thought you meant somebody's name, like, you know, the USS.
Oh, no.
Teddy Roosevelt or something.
Eh.
Well, I did hell of a lot better than I
thought.
Yeah,
you did very well. So there you go. 7 former Sabres. And yeah, boy, if only you had kept all of them, except for Casey Fitzgerald, you could have let him go.
I believe that was your, was that your
that
final email?
That was my final email, yes.
All right. Well, the final email for us this week comes from our friend Hart in Lake Echo, Nova Scotia. She says, hi, boys. I have a few thoughts on different subjects this week. He says, first off, Gustav Forsling is emerging as one of the least talked about upper echelon defensemen. If he's not offensively elite, he's certainly tremendous in his own zone. Kyle Dubas reemerges, but as president of the Penguins, to me, that's saying Shanahan's more money narrative is only part of the picture. It seems to me Dubas disliked having to run every substantial personnel move up the ladder, so in his next gig, he climbed it himself. These guys will be seeing anything in the pressers, so I'm more interested in what they do as indicators of motivation. Don't look now, but Alex Pietrangelo is poised to win his 2nd cup in 5 years. Should this bolster his Hall of Fame candidacy down the road, I would think. On the other hand, he's never scored 55 points, nor has he won a Norris Trophy. Is Alex Pietrangelo a Hall of Famer? Have a great week. Hart in Lake Echo, Nova Scotia. My off-the-cuff answer would be he's in the Hall of Good, not the Hall of Fame.
Correct.
For Alex Pietrangelo.
Yeah. He's very well respected, and he's going to have plenty of hardware.
Solid career.
But he's not a Hall of Famer. He was never one of the best defensemen in the league. He was just successful and very good, you know, so exactly what you said. Just like I don't think Ryan Suter is a Hall of Famer. There's guys that have been around for a long time. Pietrangelo has been on a couple of Stanley Cups. Suter never even made it to a Stanley Cup final, but they're just that cut below to me. So just a gut instinct. I'm not looking at the stats either. So, yeah.
Yep. Same here. All right. That will do it for this week's show. Thank you to all who took the time to send us an email, especially Matt, who did two emails and a spreadsheet.
Yeah.
For God's sakes. That's above and beyond the call right there. Appreciate it. Appreciate it to everybody. If you would like to send us an email for next week, it is very easy to do. Just go to your computer, type some things, and then send it to feedback@puckpodcast.com. We are on Twitter @puckpodcast, and the Facebook page is facebook.com/puckpodcast as well. And again, if you would like to support us on Patreon, it is patreon.com/puckpodcast. Doug, any closing thoughts before we say goodbye for another week?
No.
All right, then we thank our special guest this week. That would be Ken Bolke from Sin Bin Vegas. Great job by him. Appreciate his time. And we appreciate your time as well for taking the time to listen to our little show. We'll have another show for you next week. Until then, and remember, if there is a game number 5, we'll have the show on Wednesday. If it's a sweep, it'll be on Tuesday. But until then, for my co-host Doug Stolhan, I'm Eddie Garcia. Thank you as always for listening, and we will talk to you next week with another edition of the Puck Podcast.